Oh, look at this time schedule. Yeah, right.
Okay, I'd like to call to order this interim meeting of the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee. It is January 15th, 2014. First time I've said that in this room. Welcome, everyone. Special welcome to Representative Whitsitt. We're going to start off with an update on the Klamath. And we have a legislative concept that's related to that issue. So we want to have a good understanding of the good work that's happening down there and the impacts of the proposed settlement. And so Richard Whitman from the governor's office is going to walk us through that. I'd like to welcome him. Thanks, Richard.
Thank you, Chair Denbrough, members of the committee. For the record, Richard Whitman, Governor Kitzhaber's Natural Resources Advisor, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Chair Denbrough. Good to see you up there. So I am going to talk for a few minutes just to set the context for this discussion about the Klamath. Some of you, I think, are quite familiar with the some of you I know are quite familiar with the Klamath. Others of you may not have all the history on the Klamath, and I'm not going to go back through the entire history of the Klamath project. But suffice it to say that in 2001, we had a very dry year in the Klamath Basin that led to a shutdown of the Klamath Reclamation Project in terms of water use, severe economic consequences for that project, and enormous strife and dissension in that community. Starting in 2005 and up until 2010, there were negotiations on a series of agreements that culminated in the Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement and the Klamath Hydroelectric Settlement Agreement that were signed in the rotunda here in the state capitol in 2010 by then Governor Kulongoski, Governor Schwarzenegger, the Secretary of Interior, and many others. And those agreements resolved most of the issues, or many of the issues concerning water use in the Klamath Basin, but they did not resolve all of them. One in particular, one piece that was left really unresolved in KBRA was water use in the upper part of the basin. So just to give you a little bit of context, we have about 225,000 acres irrigated within the Klamath Reclamation Project in the lower, what I'll call today, the lower part of the basin, below Upper Klamath Lake. There are approximately another 200,000 acres of irrigated land above the lake. That area above the lake really was not resolved in the Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement. And what was left unresolved was the relative position, if you will, of the rights of the Klamath tribes to water and the rights of irrigators to water, both in that part of the basin and more broadly. The state of Oregon has been working for some time on what's called a water right adjudication to determine what water rights, and if so, what quantity of water the Klamath tribes and federal agencies have to water in the Klamath Basin, and what private rights were created prior to the start of our state water code in, I think it's 1907. So that process was completed in March of 2013, the administrative phase of the Klamath Basin adjudication, and resulted in preliminary determinations by the state that, in fact, the Klamath tribes do have water rights, made preliminary determinations of the quantity of those rights, and then quantified the other rights. So with the completion of that, now under our state system, just like in all the other Western states, we regulate first in time, first in right, so that in times of water shortage, the most junior, most recent water rights will be curtailed so that the most senior rights can be satisfied. With a relatively dry year last year in 2013, Most water users in the upper basin above Upper Klamath Lake were regulated off beginning about June 1st of the year. And again, that resulted in some substantial economic hardship to those water users, but did result in additional water for the Klamath tribes in terms of in-stream flows above the lake and water into Klamath Lake. So that's the context. And in June of 2013, Senator Wyden, chair of the Senate Energy and Environment Committee in Congress, convened a hearing in Washington, D.C. on the Klamath Basin and specifically looked at three issues: the water situation in the upper part of the basin, the cost of implementation of KBRA, and another remaining issue, which is getting low-cost power to irrigators in that particular area. Coming out of that hearing, there was agreement by Senator Wyden and Congressman Walden and Congress and Senator Merkley to convene a task force along with the governor to look at those three issues and try to resolve them. And I was tasked with leading that task force and then also as part of that leading negotiations on the remaining water issues in the upper part of the basin. In December of last year, we were able to announce an agreement in principle on the remaining water issues in the upper part of the basin. And the way I would characterize the agreement in principle is that it is essentially an outline of the deal points that have been agreed to conceptually by the parties to the negotiations. Since then, and on a continuing basis, we are continuing to meet pretty much weekly, including over the holidays, to work out the details of how those deal points will be implemented. The basic deal, if you will, in the upper basin is to reduce water use in terms of net consumptive use by irrigators above the lake by 30,000 acre feet, and therefore get that quantity of volume of water into Upper Klamath Lake. To also reduce water use, that volume to be allocated among the main tributaries to the lake in ways to meet what are called specified in-stream flows in those tributaries. And for irrigators in the upper part of the lake to agree to work with federal agencies and the tribes on restoration of riparian areas above the lake. If we are able to meet certain performance targets in terms of water and in terms of riparian restoration, the tribes would then agree to not call for regulation of water use above the lake to the levels that have been determined in the adjudication, but to lower levels, these specified in-stream flows that, frankly, are calibrated so that most of the more senior water right holders above the lake would be able to continue operation without regulation in most water years, not in the very dry years. So that's where we are. We are hopeful that we will get to completion of the final agreement on water in the upper basin here in the next few weeks. With that done, that will then trigger movement on federal legislation that is necessary to implement both the water agreements we're working on, the power pieces to get lower cost power to irrigators, and the remaining pieces of the Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement and hydroelectric settlement. As most of you are probably aware, Senator Wyden is moving or likely to move from his current chairmanship of the Energy and Natural Resources Committee over to Senate Finance, but we've been working very closely with his office, Senator Merkley's office, and Congressman Walden's office on these issues. And our expectation is that this is the year to try to come to final resolution of these issues on water in the upper basin and to get federal legislation enacted. So that's our goal. We are also simultaneously working on interim programs to put in place that will ramp up some of the programs that are involved here and provide some interim benefit to the Klamath tribes and, frankly, some interim reduced likelihood of regulation for irrigators in the upper basin as well in the coming years. With that said, we are looking at an incredibly dry water year right now. The Klamath Basin is at roughly 15% of normal, and the forecasts for the remainder of January are not good. So we appear, at least right now, to be headed into another very bad water year. It could be substantially worse than even last year, which was not a good year. So our thoughts and prayers, frankly, are with Mother Nature in terms of delivering some water out of the basin. And in the meantime, we're working as hard as we can to try to complete this work. And with that, Chair Dembrough, just one other piece, which is the Legislative Concept 157, which you've got a work session on later in today. Just very briefly, right now, in other parts of the state, we are able to do transfers and temporary transfers of water rights, both water rights to move water around to its best use and to also transfer water for in-stream use and then protect that water. In the Klamath Basin, for the rights that have been preliminarily determined in the Klamath water rights adjudication, we do not have that authority under Oregon law. In order to accomplish temporary transfers, both in-stream and out-of-stream, we need new statutory authority, and that, in essence, is what's proposed in LC 157. We are continuing to have discussions with water users in the Upper Basin, as well as other interest about this legislative concept. We very much want this to be a consensus bill. It is limited only to the Klamath Basin, and our intent is to continue to work with the stakeholders over the next few weeks to make sure that everybody is comfortable. The language that you have today reflects some initial discussions with stakeholders, but I don't want to hide that there's more work to be done on the legislative concept before we're ready to actually move it forward. And with that, I'll conclude my remarks. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for that very much, Richard. And, you know, I'll say that I know, just speaking for the rest of the committee, we want to help to make this settlement a viable one. And if the LC can help with that, then, you know, I think we want to take it very seriously. What, can you just specify what problem exactly the LC is designed to fix? What is missing right now in the agreement that actually needs this?
Chair Dembrough, members of the committee, I mentioned that one of the essential deal points is to increase inflow into Upper Klamath Lake by 30,000 acre feet on an average annual basis, and to do that by putting water in stream. What that comes down to is individual water right holders agreeing to reduce their use of water and to allow that water to remain in stream. We can do that right now, but we can't for water rights that were determined in the Klamath adjudication, the pre-1907 and the federal rights and the tribal rights. We can't protect those rights once they're in stream, so the water could actually still be used by a junior appropriator. In order really to be able to complete the deal and keep that water in stream and hit the performance targets that this whole deal in the Upper Basin is premised on, we need that statutory authority to not only leave the water in stream but to actually protect it. So that is one specific problem that the legislation addresses. Frankly, the other issue is for some of those earlier water rights, and this would include water rights within the Klamath Reclamation Project as well as above the lake, the early water rights that have been determined in the adjudication can't be transferred until the second phase of that judicial phase of that adjudication is completed. We have a final decree. You can imagine we're now over 100 years past the time that those water rights were established. Things have changed during that time, and I think there is a great desire on the part of irrigators within the Klamath Project to move things around, true up water use, really do some cleanup. We can't do that, again, without this authority and this legislation, and it would allow to take care, us to take care of that as well.
Thank you. So on the one hand, the irrigators are going to reduce the amount of diversion, but in exchange, they're going to be getting more flexibility in how they use the water that they have. Would that be a fair statement?
There will be a much lower likelihood of them being shut off through regulation is essentially what they get in return for reducing that water use. I should mention all of this is on a voluntary willing seller basis, so this all needs to be designed and, frankly, funded in a way that is realistic and acceptable to water users in that community. No one is being forced to sell their water rights or to do riparian restoration. This has to make business sense to each individual landowner.
Okay, thank you, Richard. Questions or comments? Yes, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Richard. In the LC 157 dated on the 14th, it appears that it eliminates the authorization of in-stream transfers subject to the department's final determination that was in an earlier draft. Is that the intention of the new draft?
Chair Denbrough, Senator Olson, I can't answer that question because, frankly, it's been department staff and LC that have been working on the final details of this most recent version. So I can find out the answer to that question and get back to you. But in terms of the specifics for why there were wording changes between earlier drafts and this draft, I can't answer it.
Can I follow up? Who benefits from the provisions of this act in the event that the agreement in principle is not completed or if no funding becomes available for it for the in-stream lease or split-stream lease? In short, why enact this bill if an agreement of funding does not materialize?
Chair Denbrough, Senator Olson, my answer to that is that we fully expect this agreement to be announced within the next few weeks. If the agreement does not go forward, then it really is a separate discussion about whether it makes sense to go forward with this legislation in the absence of an agreement. And our full intent is this is part of a package, and it is premised on the assumption that we will, in fact, have an agreement.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, Senator Hensel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Richard, I think I understand, but I want to make sure it's on the record of what Section 4 does in the LC 157. I'm assuming that, at least to me, it appears to continue the 2024 sunset of the split season leasing provision as it would apply to water subject to the department's final determination. Am I correct on that, or am I going to need to get somebody from the department to answer that?
Chair Denbrough, Senator Hansel, well, this is an interesting turn of events. I don't have a Section 4 in my version of the LC. So are you?
Well, bracket 4. I got a Section 4.
But
it's a
Section. I'm sorry. Yes. Section 1, bracket 4. My mistake.
All right, thank you.
My mistake.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Well, let me, Chair Denbrough, Senator Hansel, I can answer the question more directly without regard to what this LC, current version of the LC says. There is no intent to change the sunset on the current authorization for split season leasing, period.
Now, that was my understanding, but I just wanted to make sure. Okay.
I'll just be very clear about that. This is, that is a separate discussion, and there is no intent on certainly my office or any of the parties that I've been involved in on altering that current sunset.
Thank you.
Thank you, Richard. Senator Woods.
Thank you, Chair Denbrough, and thank you for inviting us to join you today.
Thank you for coming.
Mr. Whitman, you had talked about protecting water in stream to the lake, and one of my concerns is that under the current statutory arrangement for in-stream leases and split-season leases, injury and enlargement is to be determined by the department. Mm-hmm. It's not really in statute. And so it comes down to, if you make an in-stream transfer, are you going to, or in-stream lease, are you going to lease the full certificated right of that water right, or the historical use of that water right, or the actual consumptive use of that water right? Mm-hmm. And what part of that are you going to guarantee downstream? Because if you lease the full certificated paper right in stream, it will almost certainly enlarge the water right and also injure the people downstream that use the tailwater off that right. And just to make it clear, this Sprague River is 60, 70 miles long. So, I mean, it's the water gets used and over again. It's the genesis of the question.
Chair Denbrough, Senator Whitsitt, this is one of the main issues that we are in discussion with the some of the interest in the Upper Basin about. As I understand it, under current law, the department does go through an injury analysis, and as part of that analysis does look at the historic use and not the paper amount of the certificate. The intent is to do at least the same here, and if there is a need for some additional assurances to the parties in this specific area about that issue, we are open to discussing language in the bill to make clear that that injury analysis will be done as part of this program.
Okay. Follow up. That's precisely the point, in that the if it were a in-stream transfer, a permanent transfer, then it would be subject to the provisions of injury division, injury analysis provisions in the current statute. But if it's a lease or a split season lease, it is up to the department to determine, and that's where some of that angst is coming from, I believe.
All right, Chair Denbrough, Senator Whitsitt, understand the concern, and again, our intent is to address that directly in the bill.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Richard. And just before I call on you, Representative, just want to remind you that what we're dealing with here is a preliminary LC. In the work session, all we're asking is to get the process going. That's always the case with the introduction of these LCs. So, yes, Representative, what's it?
Thank you. I'm just going to, for the record, put a little background on before I ask the question here. Upper Klamath Lake's been the primary irrigation storage reservoir for the Klamath Project since the construction of the Link River Dam in 1921. Last spring, the Oregon Water Resources Department issued a limited license to authorize the Bureau of Reclamation to annually run 175,000 acre-feet of, quote, environmental water that had been previously stored for irrigation in Upper Klamath Lake down the Klamath River for the benefit of the coho salmon. And this action appears to fulfill one of the contractual provisions of the Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement, to which the Oregon Water Resources Department is a party and signatory. A lot of irrigators and attorneys believe that this action authorized an illegal enlargement of the Bureau of Reclamation water right because it functionally transferred the use of that water that the BOR had not previously used before. So the transfer of the use is for the purpose neither authorized in the Bureau of Reclamation water right nor the current purpose of the Bureau of Reclamation Klamath Project. The question is then, will anything in this LC, in the adoption of it, in its provisions of LC 157, provide an alternative means of protecting in-stream flow of the 175,000 acre feet of water currently subject to the limited license issued by the Oregon Water Resources Department in the spring of 2013.
Chair Denbrough, Representative Whitsitt, the Oregon Water Resources Department did issue a limited license to the Bureau of Reclamation, as you described, for the last water year. And that limited license, as I think you know, is not a water right. It is essentially a privilege for a one-year period to do that. That privilege can be renewed for a limited number of periods under existing Oregon law. The water that was released by the Bureau of Reclamation is water that was stored in Upper Klamath Lake. It's not natural flow into the lake that was released. In terms of what happens in the future with the Bureau's operation and releases downstream, that's somewhat of an open question. In terms of the application of this legislation to those releases, again, my answer would be pretty much the same as it was to the last question. This issue has been brought up in some of the discussions with water users in the Upper Basin, and I think is open for discussion in terms of the application of this proposed legislation to that specific activity by the Bureau of Reclamation. I will say that action has not been the main drive. It's not been really a driver among any of the discussions between the parties for this legislation. But I understand your concern, and I think it's something we're willing to talk about.
Senator,
if you don't to push the envelope just a little bit with your time, I mean, okay, there's one other question that I wanted to visit, and that has to do with the. The groundwater situation in the Upper Klamath region. The Water Resources Department has made clear that they intend to regulate as many as 200 wells, irrigation wells, in the upper regions if a call is made by the tribes, and then within any time a call is made by the tribes, because they have determined, they say, through a groundwater model that the entire region is there's at least 200 of these wells are connected to the surface water, and so that's probably a two-hour discussion. But the question is there any provisions in this LC draft, or would you intend, or would you contemplate putting any provisions in there that would allow for or accelerate the ability to transfer the water from those wells in stream?
Chair Timbrough, Senator Whitsitt, I think the short answer is no. And in terms of the groundwater issue, as you probably know, that's one of the issues that is being discussed in the negotiation, so I can't comment on the details of it other than to say it is an issue that's being addressed. In the negotiations, and my personal expectation is that the agreement will provide some clarity on this issue and in terms of what the management approach is expected to be in the future. But in terms of the relation to the legislation, I don't believe there's any relationship.
I think no is the right answer.
Yeah.
To clarify, the adjudication essentially took the water away from about 115,000 acres of formerly irrigated land, or land that was irrigated in 2012. If this proposed Oregon Water Resources Department action moves forward, that would increase it to 140,000 acres roughly, and it would take both the surface and the groundwater. It would totally dewater it, primary wells, secondary wells, the whole thing. That's it.
Okay, thank you. Richard, do you want to respond to that?
No.
You okay?
No.
All right. Thank you very
Thanks
much.
Thanks very much.
And look forward to working with you on this.
Likewise. Thank you.
Okay. With that, I will close the informational meeting on the Klamath Agreement and open a meeting on the Renewable Portfolio Standard. We're sticking with water for a while. And I'd like to call up Margie Hoffman. We had hoped that Representative Smith could be here, but he can't be here. Margie, do you want to just kick it off, or
I would love to.
Thank you.
So, Chair Dembro, members of the committee, my name is Margie Hoffman. I am Governor John Kitzhaber's energy policy advisor, and I wanted to say thank you for the opportunity to come and testify today to give you an update on the Renewable Portfolio Standard Task Force. At the end of the last legislative session, Representative Smith asked the governor to co-convene a task force to look at the Renewable Portfolio Standard, which was originally enacted in 2007 through Senate Bill 838. And it requires different different-sized utilities to meet different renewable energy targets over a certain timeline. The eligible resources include hydropower, biomass, geothermal, ocean thermal, solar, tidal, wave, wind, and hydrogen. The task force was created to look at how that law is functioning after its passage in 2007, how it's functioning in the Oregon marketplace, and to determine whether or not any updates are necessary for the state to meet the state's renewable energy targets. The task force consists of two phases. One is an assessment of different challenges and opportunities that were created by the standard and how those are functioning. And then step two would be if there is something that was identified that the task force wanted to make a recommendation to a state agency to change a rule or to the legislature to make a statutory change, then phase two of the task force would develop a consensus-based recommendation to either the agency or the legislature. The task force was co-convened by Governor Kitzhaber and Representative Greg Smith. The members of the task force include Steve Eldridge of the Umatilla Electric Co-op, Dave Markham, Central Oregon Electric Cooperative, Ted Case of the Oregon Rural Electric Cooperatives Association, Danelle Romain from the Oregon Public Utility District Association, Beth Vargas Duncan, Oregon Municipal Electricity Utility Association, Roger Gray and Jason Huser from the Eugene Water and Electric Board, Barner Seaman from Renewable Northwest Project, Marion Haynes from Portland General Electric, Scott Bolton from Pacific Power, Wendy Gerlitz from the Northwest Energy Coalition, Jeff Bissonette from the Citizens Utility Board, and Doris Penwell from the Association of Oregon Counties and Community Renewable Energy Association. We also had, as official resources to provide information to task force members, Director Schwartz from the Oregon Department of Energy, Jason Eisdorfer from the Oregon Public Utility Commission, and Crystal Ball from the Bonneville Power Administration. So I brought copies of the Renewable Portfolio Standard Task Force charter and membership, and I think that you all have those via email, but I brought extra copies if you'd like them. And I'm happy to answer. I guess the update on where we are with the task force is that trying to figure out if there is going to be a recommendation to the legislature from the task force for the 2014 legislative session. So those conversations are underway, and hopefully we will wrap them up by Thursday of next week.
So I assume a certain amount of time has been spent on the issue that is some people are trying to address through a ballot measure.
Chair Dembro, members of the committee, yes, we have had a number of meetings, six meetings, I believe, to date, about how the law is functioning and the different challenges that different utilities are facing, the different opportunities that other utilities have benefited from the Renewable Portfolio Standard. I think it's generally a very healthy process to go through looking at how this law is functioning a number of years after it was originally passed. And the group is working very hard to try to come forward with consensus recommendations for how we can strengthen and improve the law.
Any questions from Margie? We'll be hearing from some of the other members of the task force. Okay, I'll call them up, and Margie, you'll be around.
Sure.
Yeah, thanks. So we have Ted Case, Scott Bolton, Marion Haynes. Why don't we start there? Ted, do you want to?
Chair Dembrough, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ted Case. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Rural Electric Cooperative Association. We represent 18 electric co-ops in Oregon with about 200,000 members. Our power supply is primarily from the federal projects on the Columbia River system. However, we have invested in solar energy, geothermal, landfill gas, and even wave energy. Appreciate the opportunity to talk about the RPS task force, which I've been a part of. I think we started in September. As Margie said, we met, I think, six times and have many conversations offline, et cetera. So here's the update from our end. We have, as Margie said, we've looked at challenges and opportunities. And, you know, for my membership, one of the big challenges has been what to do when a small non-generating electric cooperative like Umatilla Electric Cooperative, all of a sudden, because of the data centers that move into their service territory, will be thrust into the large standard at 25%, just like my colleagues here to my right, PGE and PacifiCorp. Never really envisioned by the authors of the RPS that type of load would come on that quickly and take a very small electric co-op and put them in the same standard as those that have 800,000 customers like PGE. So that has been the challenge for the task force to look, how can we mitigate any cost issues that come out of that type of growth? And we spent a lot of time talking about the type of tools and compliance that could come to help smooth those costs and to mitigate the rate shock. And we're all about keeping the cost low for our consumers. So I'm pleased to report that we've come a long way on this, and I think we have some agreement amongst the group. Margie talked about a consensus recommendation, and I think we're pretty close to that, to try to provide additional compliance tools with respect to renewable energy credits for consumer-owned utilities like Umatilla to help them mitigate the cost. And it would be sort of a stair-step process when they come into the full compliance. So there's a lot of details that need to be worked out. But if we can work them out, I think it would obviate the necessity of a ballot measure, the Hydro's renewable ballot measure, and also to have a sort of detente on the issues of the RPS for a couple sessions. And I think everybody at this table and certainly probably in this committee would welcome that type of detente. So if this can all get worked out, I think that we would move ahead during the February session. And a lot of credit goes to Representative Greg Smith and Margie for keeping the group together. There's a lot of passion around the RPS, as you can imagine, and finding common ground is very difficult. And I think that we're getting there. Also want to compliment the Oregon Department of Energy, Alicia Schwartz and her team. Julie Peacock buried us in spreadsheets, but I think because of that data that showed what the costs could be to Umatilla Electric Cooperative and others, it really helped, I think, in my opinion, break the gridlock and help us find a solution. So there's other issues that, along with this, that I think Scott and Marion will talk about with respect to some of their interests. But I'm hopeful that everything can be worked out in a very compressed time frame and that we can bring a consensus recommendation to the legislature next month and get it through. So with that, I would be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Ted. Let's hear from the other two and then take questions. Scott, welcome.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, for the record, Scott Bolton on behalf of Pacific Power. We were born in the large utility compliance category as a large utility serving the state. As many people know, Pacific Power serves about 550,000 customers across the state with a very diverse customer base ranging from Senator Dembrough's district to Senator Whitsitt's district and a lot of points in between. for the most part, we believe, and as a frankly, as a company that experiences renewable standards in numerous states that we operate in, we've long believed that the Oregon standard, which was crafted through pretty vigorous negotiation through much of the 2007 session, has done a pretty good job of promoting a policy direction for investment in the state of Oregon, while also providing adequate controls and checks and balances on costs and where we've experienced some difficulties along the way, we've been able to address those. The issues that Umatilla and frankly some of the smaller consumer-owned utilities may be facing as we have additional growth and development in certain parts of the state bring us to this particular task force question, and it's one of the ideas that really came to the fore, I think, through the committee's work, is that not only is this an energy policy, not only is this, frankly, when you strip it down, just a procurement standard for utilities on how you acquire your next resources and where the preference is around that, but I think the impact that this policy has had on economic development. I think initially it was really seen as an economic development tool for the development of generation. You know, let's have more wind and solar, let's invest in hydro and get more efficiency out of existing projects because there will be recognition of that. Let's look at existing technologies like biomass and biogas and where do they bring value to the table. I think where capital has been deployed into those types of technologies and resources, whether to serve Oregon or to serve other states or other customers, has been probably the central economic development story. What we're experiencing and what we're seeing now is customers, large consumers, don't just want cheap anymore. They want to participate. They want to have service from these types of resources. And so part of the discussion around tweaking the renewable standard to find lower cost compliance strategies for utilities who find themselves into a higher category is also how do you look at the interrelation between the RPS and other existing laws to make sure that at the end of the day, consumers get what they want. It's not just low cost power in some cases, it's also greener power or power located in a certain place or a certain carbon content. That's what we're hearing from our customers as something that they value. Of course, there's always going to be those who see electricity as a really simple commodity and want that as cheap as possible because that's what helps keep their business, their enterprise competitive, and we stand firm in our belief and ability to provide them that. But where we also are experiencing customers who want something different and are willing to pay for that, that has also been something that we think is intrinsically tied to this conversation because it really is about how do we keep Oregon as a whole and certainly the communities that we serve economically competitive. If there's a business that wants to site in a certain community, how do we make sure that not only do we have an affordable and reliable product to serve them with, but that we actually have the color of product that they want to be served with? And we have enough examples now of where Oregon has seen some missed opportunities that we feel like that's a pretty central part of this discussion. So that was part of the conversation as it evolved through this RPS task force. It's actually, if people take a step back, a fairly exciting part of the conversation because I think it shows some of the directions and some of the ethics that these policies can take on. And if we manage them correctly, I think we can grow opportunity while also protecting the interests of those who are impacted by decisions that companies like mine have to make under Oregon's requirements. So happy to take any questions and hand the mic to my colleague.
Thank you. Thank you very much for that, Scott.
Chair Dembro, members of the committee, my name is Marion Haynes. I represent Portland General Electric, also a large utility under the current RPS. We have about 835,000 customers, largely in the northern Willamette Valley. I won't take too much of your time because I think Scott really spoke to what's really a lot of our interest in this discussion. I would emphasize that we, too, are hearing from customers that care about the resource and the mix of the resources that are in the that's in the energy that is serving them, and we would like to be able to accommodate what our customers are asking us to do. They want more choices, and we would like to be able to facilitate what it is that they're asking from us. So, as Scott said, I do think that this is, it's an intrinsic part of this conversation that we've been having. It's about renewables, it's about customers, it's about cost impacts to customers, who pays, who's willing to pay, and how to match up all those things. And I think with the components that we've been talking about here that you heard from Scott and from Mr. Case as well, I think we are honing in on something that, that will really work for the various and sometimes different utilities and customers throughout the state of Oregon that will be to the benefit of the whole when all is said and done. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, all three of you. So just following up on your testimony, Marion, so the you know, the goal that you're trying to reach is to kind of strike a balance between affordable rates and customer choice and not creating onerous requirements on small utilities that are growing. Just looking at the history of the RPS so far, how substantial has been the burden on ratepayers of this strategy of, you know, creating a procurement standard, as it were?
Chair Denboro, members of the committee, for PGE, we recently filed a compliance report with the Oregon Public Utility Commission for our RPS obligation and investments to date, and that impact has been less than 1% for ratepayers. So it's been pretty minimal at this point, up until this point. When we do look at costs associated with compliance, it's important to remember that we make investments to serve our customer demand. So we could invest in wind, we could invest in a gas plant. Investments will happen. So while folks have seen rate increases over the time since the RPS has been in place, many of those would have happened but for the RPS anyway, because we need investments to serve the demand that our customers have. So,
yeah, Chair Brent Denboro, members of the committee, I thought that was well covered by Marion. I think the only additional data point I'd want to share is that, you know, particularly investor-owned utilities do integrated resource planning. That's a long-term, 20-year look at our resource needs, and we identify based on where we think loads are going to be, increased demand, as well as where other resources are in their life cycle. So do we have a contract rolling off? Do we have a plant that needs to be changed out? And so when we look at that, that's when we identify when we're in the period where we need to make new power plant investment. And we make those decisions, you know, forecasted in a pretty robust process where stakeholders and regulators look at our plans, weigh in on whether we're looking at the right things. And when it comes time for investment, you know, we have a window in which we need to get the next 200 or 300 megawatts of power. If you look at when the majority of Oregon Renewables were acquired by my company and frankly PGE as well, during that period, wind in particular was very cost competitive with other resources. And in particular, when you look at natural gas as your next power plant option, gas back in the period of 2008 to 2010 or so, or even further back, 2006 to 2010 or so, was about three times what it is today. And so against the backdrop of when we were acquiring those resources, wind actually penciled out really well. If we were to make those same investments today, considering the gas revolution around fracking and what the cost of natural gas is today, it would be a harder case to make. So Marion's right. We have had cost increases, absolutely, as a result of needing more energy and adding energy to our portfolio. But as far as the cost of compliance with this particular policy, looking at when those investments were made, the levelized cost has actually been fairly negligible.
Thank you. Yes, Senator Hanson.
I just want to make sure I'm understood. I'm since the RPS standards came into play, you're saying the consumer has only experienced a 1% increase in rates? Is that what I heard you say?
Senator Hansel, what you're hearing me say is that because of the RPS as a requirement, it has, in fact, in our case, it's been negligible. It hasn't even been a 1% increase because of that policy. Consumers have experienced rate increases since then. Absolutely. Since 2007, our customers have had rate increases. Those rate increases have been associated with investments in transmission, distribution, system upgrades, as well as new power plants. And many of those new power, not all, we've had three new natural gas plants come in during that time. But we've also had several wind farms and some solar also come in during that same time. And all of that new power plant has costs and has increased rates. But as far as Oregon's policy saying, as a procurement standard, we prefer or you have to have a certain amount of renewables, compliance with that policy has not been a major cost impact.
Follow up,
please.
Will that continue into the future?
Senator Hansel, committee members, I can't tell you what the future holds, especially in energy.
Because they ramp up.
Well, if right now we are in a good compliance position where we feel like we've managed the costs of the public policy against what our system needs are. You know, there was actually very good alignment between the timing of when the RPS was passed with when we needed new resources, and those resources were very cost competitive in the marketplace. As I said, if we had to go back out tomorrow and say we were mandated to get another 100 megawatts of renewables versus what would be available on the market, either through hydro contracts or through new gas plant investment, gas is probably the cheapest resource on a levelized basis. A lot of it has to do with the timing of when you need the resource, when you're in the market, and what that marketplace is telling you as far as the cost of technologies.
If I heard correctly, between the two of you, you probably have 1,300,000 customers, 500,000 and 800,000, something like that.
Sure. About 1.2, 1.3 million. It constitutes about 70% of the state's customer base.
How do you determine, I'm just curious, I would think that within that type of database, you will hear from customers all over the board, and you both referred to, we have customers that want this, and then you mentioned about who's willing to pay and who pays. And it seems to me that you could probably hear from, you would have enough variety that you would hear from customers for whatever way you decide you want to go anyway. I'm just curious, does majority rule, or how do you, I'm curious as to how you determine what your customers want and therefore move forward with what your policy is.
Well, let me be really clear on that. As far as what our customers want to pay for electricity, it's all over the map as far as what kind of resources they want to be served with.
So you could justify whatever decision you make based upon what you've heard.
No, I mean, the RPS was majority rule of this body, not any utility company deciding what we're going to invest in. I mean, we're investing in what we think makes economic sense and what the best business case is for.
Okay.
That simple. I guess when I talk about as part of the conversation that's currently ongoing around amending the RPS is that there are opportunities to provide renewable power to those customers who specifically want to pay, who voluntarily say that they want to pay for more, that they want to be served in a different way than what we're currently doing as regular load service. That's all.
If I could just add on briefly, Senator Hansel, I do think that Scott's discussion about the integrated resource planning is an important one, and that really is where our resource decisions are made. We look out at a 30-year forecast. We have a 5-year action plan. It's updated every 2 years. Stakeholders participate in that process, and there are frameworks around decision-making and what kind of investments that we make that exist within that process. So looking at least cost, least risk resources, still meeting meeting the policy obligations that we have, but there are frames that really focus on controlling costs for customers as best as we can, recognizing that there's risks out there and fuel volatility and things like that. And so all of these things are evaluated in a very lengthy public process at the PUC.
Thank you. Senator Hansel brought it up on your 1.3 million customers. Can you tell me the percentage of those customers that prefer renewables over current or standard hydro and gas generation?
Chair Dambrow, Senator Olson, I think the only way to arrive at an answer to your question would be to poll customers. We have different measurements as far as participation in things like our Blue Sky program. So we have customers who elect to pay a little bit more on their monthly bills. Those are offered primarily to residential and commercial customers. We have some industrial participation. And frankly, PGE and Pacific Power are among the top three in the nation as far as customer participation in those programs.
Well, if they participate, then you should know what the percentage is as to those that don't.
And I could probably follow up with you on that as far as what that exact percentage is. But I guess to your question, to drill deeper, whether they prefer renewable power over gas or hydro, that's not something we have visibility into unless we were to ask them those specific questions, because for us, it's all mixed. We have coal, we have gas, we have hydro, we have everything. It's just a question of whether their regular, plain vanilla service is satisfactory or whether they want something above and beyond that.
Well, if they relied totally on renewable, there'd be many times they wouldn't have any power at all, right?
Nighttime, except when the wind's blowing really hard, and other times of the day, absolutely. It's all a mix.
Follow up?
Please.
Prior to the renewable, the RPS in 2007, and had not wind energy had such tremendous tax credits and support from the government itself, which is, in fact, taxpayer dollars, would you, in your business plan, have looked to wind energy and solar energy if we relied strictly on our hydro facilities that we had at the time and the facilities you had that were on board? Would you have made that business decision to go into and do solar or wind?
Well, Senator Olson, I think absolutely the level of incentives plays a part in the economics of making these decisions. So, and it also has a lot to do with the timing of these investments. So the presence of the federal production tax credit absolutely helped the economics of wind and made wind a more valuable choice. I'll also say other tax credits incentives have also been very useful in making other plant investments. So for instance, when we've invested in natural gas plants, we've used bonus depreciation on that plant as well. So for us, it's not necessarily technology specific, it's just cheap. What's the lowest cost way we can serve our customers? So if the federal government, through its stimulus package, is offering bonus depreciation on capital investment for a period of time, we're going to look hard at, is this a good time to build transmission lines? Is this a good time to build gas plants? Is this a good time to use the PTC to build wind plants? We don't have access to the federal Columbia Hydro system. Our hydro is very limited to what we already have existing and privately held in our portfolios. So when we have incremental growth, we have to be in the market for generally another technology, and that's going to be gas or wind, because frankly the risks around coal right now and the risks around our current coal fleet are such that we're probably not going to be able to invest in new resources.
But won't you agree that the problem with wind or solar energy is the fact that you need to keep a backup replacement generation system in and on, ready to go online, and it's more costly to have that start and stop than it would be a continuous operation. So therefore, you're escalating the cost of electricity to the folks because of this need.
Yeah, Chair Dembrough, Senator Olson, I absolutely, one of the greatest challenges that we have right now is integrating intermittent resources or non-dispatchable resources such as renewables or wind and solar in particular. Right now, the penetration of those resources are such that we can economically back those resources with our existing hydro and gas plants. There is a point, I think, when we start getting into higher percentages required of actual energy, where that will become even more challenging. That's one of the motivations Pacific Corp has had in exploring an energy imbalance market and working with the state of California into how we can more dynamically transfer capacity. So think of it almost as during periods where we have high ramp-ups of those resources, we have somewhere to go with those on a real-time, five-minute-ahead basis. Also, when we have, lower dispatch, when the wind's not blowing and the sun's not shining, that we have multiple places to pull into our system to help balance that out. So you're right. I mean, it is a challenge. It's one that we're going to solve primarily through better market interconnectivity. And we should be ready to launch that energy imbalance market initiative in October of this year.
Thank you. Okay, thank you. If you have a quick one, we
have
another panel. I
arguably have overstayed my invitation, but if I might ask a clarifying question.
We'll see what the question is, then I'll answer.
Okay. One of the you both have stated that that the RPS is costing you about 1% or 0.5% or somewhere in that ballpark. But I had a long conversation with the PUC here 2-3 months ago, and one of the things that they clarified to me is that all of the cost of to the taxpayer, essentially the tax credits, the federal energy production tax credit, the BETCs, the cost of accelerated depreciation, the cost of loan guarantees, all of that is not calculated into your ratepayer because, in fact, your ratepayer is not paying; it's the taxpayer that's paying it. And if you take just Shepherd's Flat, for instance, something like 80% of the cost of Shepherd's Flat was paid by the taxpayer, and a good deal of the production cost is being borne by the federal energy tax credit, which is a taxpayer too. So I think to say that 1% is the reaction to the RPS is technically correct, but perhaps somewhat misleading as to the total cost. Would you agree with that?
The PUC's mandate and what we're tracking against as required under the policy is what is the cost to our customers.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you.
I'd also just want to make it really clear, Shepherd's Flat serves Southern California Edison. We don't buy from that project.
And county services in Eastern Oregon. Okay, thank you. Thank you all three of you. Let's call up the next panel, and that's Varner Seaman and Doris Penwell.
Thank you very much.
That's great. Okay. Varner, you probably heard some things you want to react to, but keep it brief.
I'll keep it pretty brief. clearly, the sight of me coming here is enough to have Senator Hansel walk away. Chairman Dembro, members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to be here today. For the record, my name is Varner Seaman. I'm the policy director for Renewable Northwest Project. I just want to at first thank the governor's office for convening this process, as well as Representative Smith's office for convening this work group. I think there was a lot of hard conversation, but I think ultimately some pretty good conversation over the last few months. I also want to make a little bit of a nod towards Ted Case with ARECA and the work that he's done on this process. I think, like I said, it's been, I think, overall pretty productive and some good headway. I've submitted written testimony. I won't go through in the interest of time all of it, but just to raise a couple of different points and just call your attention to a few different things. The first is, I think one of the questions which has been around this conversation is the role of hydroelectric power and whether it's counted as renewable in the state of Oregon. In the fourth paragraph of my written testimony, there's a reference to how there's existing within law for Oregon acknowledgement of Tier 1 federal hydropower and a requirement that no procurement for the RPS could displace Tier 1 power for those who currently have an allocation for Tier 1 hydropower. One area where hydropower is acknowledged. It's also worth noting, and it's one of the things that came to light through, and some appreciation goes to Bonneville and Crystal Ball with Bonneville Power Administration being part of this conversation in the Department of Energy. One of the things that we see for the majority of customer-owned utilities in the state of Oregon who are eligible to receive efficiency upgrade credits for efficiency upgrades to the existing hydropower system, that those credits, when those efficiency upgrades occur, will go a long way towards meeting the ongoing needs of or the RPS requirement for many of the consumer-owned utilities here in the state of Oregon. So if folks are wondering if hydropower gets counted, I would say efficiency upgrades on the Grand Coulee system certainly are hydropower and do count under the standard, and we had some, I think, good modeling that took place through this exercise to show hydropower being able to count towards many utilities' needs under this law, for just to make that note. With that said, as we've talked about already, for some fast-growing utilities, including Umatilla Electric Co-op, there are some questions about how you do the cost allocation and dealing with those large loads coming on and a relatively small utility moving to the large 25% category. I'll just reiterate what Mr. Kay said and what I think some of the other members of the panels in the last group said. I think that we've figured out a way to have some additional flexibility that can be given to those utilities in that limited circumstance that can help them go some way towards alleviating any cost concerns that they have. And I think that we've worked out, in concept, we're still hammering out some details in terms of bill language, but I think we've come up with a pretty good agreement that gets us there. To be fair, we think that in doing so, we may sacrifice a little bit of new build of new renewables and potentially foregoing a little bit of additional economic investment in what would probably be Senator Hansel's district. Folks had asked for that flexibility, and we think that it's a reasonable accommodation to build into the law. And with that, as we went around the room and we had investor-owned utilities, consumer-owned utilities, including co-ops in the conversation, it was impressive, I think, for many of the members of the task force to see how, by and large, there is support and not too much consternation with the RPS and the way that it's structured. And I think overall pretty good support for the policies that are there. I think we're going to look at making a fairly minor modification to the RPS and looking at potentially some other kind of competition issues going forward. And the one point that the last panel was making, which I think is worth reiterating, and what I thought was interesting in this conversation is this was less a conversation about should we continue to invest in new renewable energy in the state of Oregon, and more a conversation about what are the business models that we have for making those investments in new renewable energy and what are the arrangements for delivering that power. Less a conversation of should we, and interestingly, and I think that the folks from PacifiCorp and PGE talked about it, I think eloquently, that there is for the state of Oregon some degree of competitive advantage in attracting new investment and new business on an ongoing basis to providing renewable energy to new businesses that are looking to locate in the state, especially high-tech companies that have a pretty strong desire for this type of product to be able to serve their electricity needs. So hopefully we can get this wrapped up and have a bill to come back and talk to you about in some detail as we go into the short session. But I think that we've had a good process. I think people have engaged pretty diligently in it. And my hope is that that will settle the need to talk about RPS issues for some time going forward in front of this body. Thank you.
Thank you,
Governor. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Doris Penwell, and I represent the Association of Oregon Counties, and I participated with this work group representing the association. It's been a wonderful experience, frankly, as some of these things tend to be, because you finally get down to the real issues that are causing heartburn for folks. And it's really been helpful for us to learn from each other about what's going on from our perspective. Us not being a utility, us not being a developer, we represent, you know, the counties and the citizens and what's going on in our communities. And as Barner says, it's been very interesting that all the people of this work group and then others we talked to have essentially supported the RPS mostly for several reasons. It's been a good marketing tool for Oregon, and we know this because we've made just a tremendous investment in Oregon. And it may have come at a good time, but we're glad to have had it because, frankly, it's one of the first things that has helped rural Oregon in maybe 50 years in terms of investment and sending money to the coffers of the public entities, and therefore that is helping sustain a lot of things that otherwise would be going away. The other thing is that I think we were very fortunate when we developed the RPS in 2007 that we had had a work group first that developed the issues that were out there and then came to the legislature and developed the RPS and had to negotiate hard on these issues. And it helped because we developed off-ramps that, limits as to how far you had to go to comply with the RPS. That's helped a lot. And finally, when we developed, as we've lived with the RPS over these few years, just few years, and you have to look at this over long term, we've made some technical changes to the RPS to accommodate things that we may not have fully recognized in the beginning. This is just one more time when we will likely recommend to you some good changes that are quite small compared to the overall RPS. And as you know, I mean, I just can't be from the counties, especially the northern tier of Oregon, without saying that the RPS has been a very positive advantage for those counties. And if you look at the demographics and the economics of those counties, it's really helped. So those folks tend to support this sort of thing. And they want to make sure that the RPS stays intact as much as possible so that, you know, we just don't throw things out because other people have better ideas. I do think that the negotiations going on, both with Umatil Electric and the other utilities, as well as the industrial or the investor-owned utilities, is quite healthy, and that we will be very happy to support what's happening. I think we're in the final phases of this stuff, but I think it will be a small technical fix having to do probably with, you know, the renewable energy certificates, et cetera, and then some other good things that other utilities can use. But I have to say before I end that one of the discussions we've had is the initiative that's out there that is sort of making everybody pay attention. And so I think, that may be healthy, it may not be, but I think that may be part of the final discussions among legislators and the folks that are part of the work group. So thank you for entertaining us.
Yes, thank you. Any questions for?
Just real quick. Yes. If hydro currently, you know, the Bonneville Power Administration, the dams that were taken out of the mix before, if initiative is passed and they become a part of the mix, what happens to RPS?
You go first.
Okay.
Chair Dembrough, Senator Hansel. There's some simple math I think that's important to understand, that we have about 45% of the electricity in the state of Oregon currently comes from hydroelectric power, and we have RPS. I think we nominally say it'll be a 25% RPS, but when you look at lower requirements for smaller utilities, for instance, those that serve less than 1.5% of electrical load in the state have a 5% requirement by 2025, and those that a little bit larger, have a 10% requirement. So I think functionally we end up with about a 23% standard. If you have 45% hydro and a 23% renewable portfolio standard, the short answer is you've more than doubled the standard on the day that you make those legacy resources effective. Personally, I think that as we look at the issue of whether or not hydro should have been counted, or if there was a drafting error or an oversight or some sort of error that was made in 2007 when it was drafted, I have to say, if you were to draft a bill and say we're going to have a 25% target to meet something which is 45% of what we're using currently, then that would become, I think, a fairly silly bill at the onset and, you know, on its face. And so I think the notion that there was some sort of an oversight or an error in originally drafting it, that it was short-sighted, I would disagree with that. I think that what we've seen is from, if you go back to about 1965 in the state of Oregon, the vast majority, something like 95% of our electrical needs were met with hydroelectric power. Since the 60s, we've developed some gas, some coal resources, including about a third of our electricity comes from coal from Montana and Wyoming today. And I think that really what we're talking talking about is trying to build on those resources. And again, I was making reference earlier under the RPS providing credit towards upgrades to the existing hydroelectric system and having those count. If anything, I think that the hydro or the RPS is providing some incentive, not necessarily that it's the main driver of this, but some incentive for us getting better use out of the existing hydroelectric system. So long answer to a short question, but the short takeaway is if hydroelectric power, all of it, the legacy, that 45% were counted, we would have met the standard at the day the law was passed, and effectively would nullify the intent of that law. It, also bringing into question then, I think, for those who've made those early investments, Eugene Water Electric Board, PacifiCorp, PGE, and for those ratepayers, it brings in some degree of uncertainty in terms of how the Utilities Commission, on a going forward basis, for those that are regulated, how those investments would be treated.
Thank you. Doris, did you want to comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Hansel. From our perspective, the development of the RPS had to do with looking forward, not looking back. And we knew that we were coming into a situation where we needed more energy. And we're not building any more dams. So if you include, I mean, everything is going forth. Anything new counts. Hydro is definitely renewable. If we had another dam and put all the money into investing in one, it would count. I don't know what the impact on our rates would be, but it's all going forth. And so I think that's the major reason that it wasn't included. Plus, we had utilities that had different mix of what their base power was. And so we had to accommodate everybody, not just some. And I think that was the other part of the reason why we selected, the legislature selected, the 25% rather than the 60% or whatever it might have been. And you can certainly have other people that were involved in that discussion respond to that question, but I think that's essentially the reason we are where we are. And it gives some direction to utilities to look for power that's better, that saves the planet, and at all of the times, caring about what the cost is. So that's my perspective.
Thank you. I think that's a very good summary. Thank you both. Did you have a question?
Just a quick question, maybe sure. More like curiosity. Upgrades to the hydropower system were mentioned here, and you've mentioned them too.
Mm-hmm.
Can you give me an idea what those are exactly, and what's the potential in the future for how much more power you can generate by upgrades to the present system?
My very rough, Mr. Chairman, Senator, my very rough understanding is that, you know, if you've got a turbine that was installed and you've got the engineering that we had in place in the 1940s or 1950s for the generating station within a hydroelectric facility, that we've basically been able to improve design and get a little bit more power out of, you know, sort of swapping that out. I mean, think about, you know, a car engine or an airplane engine or something like that, that the engineering has improved over time. There's a useful life for these things. We, you know, if you have something that's rated to produce 100 megawatts of power, you take it out and you put in something that generates 110 megawatts of power, there's some potential there. I saw Crystal Ball with Bonneville in the room earlier. I'd defer any sort of the specific and especially engineering questions to Crystal. But I said automobile engine. That exhausted my knowledge of engineering. But I think that, you know, generally the notion is that, you know, we've gotten better at our engineering over time, and within the law we recognize that there's some additional capacity that we can get out of those existing impoundments, and we should seek to do that.
Yeah.
I was really trying to get to an idea of what the scale of it is. We're talking 2 or 3 percentage points, or are we talking 25 percentage points? And as an example, Lost Creek Dam in our area doesn't produce any power. It's a huge dam,
mm-hmm.
and it produces enough power to run the dam and nothing else. There's no power lines to mm-hmm. it. I mean, those are the kind of things we think about.
This is the real nerdy part of me, Senator, that the biggest growth that we're anticipating seeing nationally in hydroelectric power are from flood control dams in the Midwest. Places like Iowa and Illinois are going to have some of the biggest growth because we have a lot of these dams where we haven't, you know, we've got an impoundment, we're using it for flood control, we're not getting electricity out of it, and I think it's sort of a cool policy area moving forward to figure out how we do some of that.
Okay. Thanks. And to completely, I think if you ask the Department of Energy and whatever about that question, they, because they know which projects have been built, and they can give you a pretty good list of those kinds of things that are happening and maybe figure out what the percentage is. But it's more than you might expect, and it's sort of refreshing to know that that's out there.
Okay. All right. Thank you, both of you. And thanks to everyone who testified on this and for your work on this task force. It sounds as if we're near the tail end of this process, and we may see some legislation in February. And if so, stay tuned. Okay. So with that, I'll close this session on Renewable Portfolio Standard Task Force. Did you want to call? Okay.
Do you want to transfer that?
She's on.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to open a.
Just quiet.
I'm going to open an informational hearing on radon, and
kids all went out. But what
okay.
Did you guys do? Stayed home.
Should be. We're good.
Okay, great.
Had the kids in
Andrea,
for
are you on?
Had a good time.
Andrea.
Didn't do much. Ate too much.
Yes.
Are you there?
Yeah.
Yes, I am.
Oh, okay. Thanks.
All right. Good. Okay, so we have an LC that we're going to ask you to approve the submission of later on related to radon, LC 243. And it is looking at a couple of issues related to radon, one having to do with radon mitigation when schools are seeing their energy efficiency upgrades being contemplated, and then one having to do with certification of people who do the radon work. And this is, I think the goals of this bill are very good. I'm not sure that the LC is quite there yet. I'm hoping to convene a group in the next week or two to help if there are any issues that arise. So we have a few people who are going to talk to us about radon. If you, please, as you come up, if you see any issues that you want, that you think we should definitely include in this LC that are not there, or anything in it that should be affected, please let us know. We really value your input. So I'd like to call up Steve Tucker from Cascade Radon. And Marshall Runkle from Clean Energy Works, and Brett Cherry from the Oregon Health Authority. And on the phone, and she'll be giving us input in a few minutes, is Andrea Siemens from the Building Codes Division. So, gentlemen, what do you think? Who should go first? What makes sense to you all?
Chair Dembrow, it's probably myself. My name is Brett Cherry. I work with the Oregon Health Authority. I'm a program manager. I manage the Healthy Homes and Schools program. I also manage the Oregon Radon program. So I can probably go first, give a little bit of a heads up as to what radon is, and then kind of pass this off to the folks around me, if that works.
Please.
So I'm not sure how familiar you are with what radon is, but it's a naturally occurring radioactive gas. It comes out of the ground. It is a carcinogen. It causes cancer. So it's actually the leading cause of lung cancer, the second leading cause of lung cancer in general, and it's the leading cause of lung cancer in non-smokers. The Environmental Protection Agency estimates that about 21,000 people per year pass away from radon-induced lung cancer. So it's a pretty big deal. Radon can become trapped in our homes and schools. It can be drawn in through pressure differences between the home and the surrounding soil. The only way to know if radon is actually in a structure is to test for it. So testing is critical. We can kind of go into the measurement piece. I don't want to kind of bore you with too many of the details, but the Environmental Protection Agency recommends that homes be fixed and schools be fixed if they have levels of 4 picocuries per liter or greater. So radon is measured in picocuries per liter, just a measurement. In Oregon, the levels of radon do vary across the state. So there are particular areas that have higher concentrations than others. For example, the Portland area, from the test results that we see for homes, somewhere between a quarter and a third of the homes test four picocuries per liter or above. So it's a good chunk of homes in the Portland area that actually have a significant radon problem. We don't have test results for a good chunk of the state. So we know certain areas do have issues, and certain areas we're just not really sure of from the data that we've gotten. The Environmental Protection Agency recommends that all houses be tested, regardless of where they're located. They recommend that all schools be tested as well. The thing to keep in mind here is that radon levels, if they are detected at high levels, they can be fixed. And I think that's where I can kind of pass this over to Steve Tucker, who actually does radon measurement and mitigation in the state of Oregon.
Thanks for letting me be here.
Thanks for being here, Steve.
My name's Steve Tucker, and I've been a certified radon specialist for over 22 years, as well as a building contractor. So I've read over the draft, and I guess I just wanted to speak to, I guess, a couple, well, to the main points. I think certification, showing proof of certification is a good thing. I've seen, and other people in the country have seen, too many instances where someone who doesn't know what they're doing, as in any specialty trade, can screw things up and cause more problem than it was started with. I've seen where, and there's also issues, I think, that maybe are aside from this discussion with guarantees and liability, particularly for a homeowner. Who do they turn to after the fact if something's not good, or 3 years later they decide to test a home and found they've been living with high radon levels when, in fact, they had a system put in per code that's doing nothing. As far as the addition piece, building remodels and additions, very often when a basement is remodeled, number one, it's much easier to solve a problem, build it in both aesthetically and effectively during a building process, just like you'd build in plumbing or HVAC or heating or electrical, rather than after the fact and retrofitting it. And in fact, in the city of Portland, there's some pretty restrictive zoning code as far as retrofits. So homeowners stuck with possibly higher cost and less effective systems because of that. Also with additions, the existing building code, I was honored to be asked to be part of and speak to the work group, the Oregon Building Codes work group here in Salem, and adding my expertise to that discussion. I asked that testing be included, pre-occupancy testing, that's an industry standard. EPA asked for that as well. The building codes folks told me that wasn't their jurisdiction, so I'm going to guess that might fall to somebody like you. And essentially, the codes don't have any teeth to them because of that. I can show you photos. I brought one with me on my cell phone, but I can think of lots of instances where I've seen where builders themselves or their plumber have put in radon systems per code. They've been signed off building by building officials. They're doing nothing, or they were put in improperly. So the other thing I asked one time, because we run in, since I do mitigation work, the code for radon mitigation for building codes, it's in the Oregon Specialty Structural Code, only speaks to new standalone structures. It doesn't speak to additions. So I'm constantly asked by architects, homeowners, and builders for interpretation of what the heck the code means. And so I then go to the building departments, whether it's West Lynn, whether it's in Salem or Portland or wherever it is. We work in Washington as well and get the same sort of thing there because they have a somewhat similar code. I'll give you one case of interpretation, I think, where the addition having additions added to the code or to the code would be helpful. I asked the building codes division, so you're telling me that if someone has a 500 square foot bungalow cottage, which is teeny, and adds 10,000 square feet to it, the code does not apply? Yes, it does not. That to me is ludicrous, just from a practical, logical standpoint. That's that part of it. As far as schools go, I've tested and mitigated a number of schools in all three western states, California, Oregon, and Washington. And it's been my experience that that many schools and school districts either don't know enough about it, are completely ignorant of it, or for one reason or another seem to shovel it under the carpet. And parents and even staff that work at the school aren't aware sometimes of just the potential that they are living with or working with, I guess, in this case. And so I know I witnessed one time coming down to speak to a PTA group here in Salem when Candelaria Elementary School had found that they had elevated levels. And I think at the beginning I felt like there was a little bit of torches and pitchforks. And it took a little while of talking logic and what the EPA protocols for testing were, and that the school district was in fact following those nicely, and that the situation could be remedied, which it was. I just think that there's too many, whether it's daycare all the way up to colleges, if you will, that just don't test. And if they have tested, it's often not to EPA protocols. There are a couple things in the draft legislation that I think would be helpful to tighten it. On page 2, lines 24 and 25, and I think that's repeated at least a couple times, it says to test all ground contact rooms. This is in child care and schools. Test all ground contact rooms, a facility that may be occupied by children. EPA says test all ground contact rooms that are occupied. And I am hoping I'm speaking for, like, my own children's high school, where I know that the counselors and the staff that work there are also subject potentially to high radon levels, so not just the kids. Let's see. On page 3, lines 2, 3, and 4 at the top of the page, I believe I'm reading this right, where it's talking about if as long as an institution has submitted documentation of a test, they don't have to retest. The EPA recommends testing periodically. The EPA also recommends that any at least initial screening tests be done during the cold weather heating season. I think that's important. Radon levels fluctuate dramatically sometimes from season to season. School is often occupied during the winter, if I'm not incorrect. And so I think it's critical that those tests be done. Otherwise, if someone tests during the summer or during a holiday season when the HVAC system is different than when it's occupied, you can have dramatically different results. One has to be very careful of how they test, particularly a school facility. And I think also I think I already spoke to on page 4, line 24 through 26, at the bottom of the page, testing before occupancy. I'm not sure I spoke to that, but essentially the code, the way it is now, there is no testing required whatsoever for radon after a building's built or an addition's done. So there is no teeth to what's been done at all. Testing's simple, it's inexpensive, and it really puts the proof in the pudding, if you will. That's it, basically. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Steve. Let's go ahead.
If you have any questions about the nuts and bolts of radon, I'd be glad to.
Yes, thank you. Marshall, let's hear from you, and then we'll see if there are any questions.
Good afternoon, Chair Dumbrough, members of the committee. Thanks for the opportunity to testify. I apologize, I have a PowerPoint presentation. Thanks a lot to Beth for helping me figure out how to get it here. So I'm going to just do a very quick talk about what Clean Energy Works is, what we do, and then talk about how our contractors that work with Clean Energy Works have solved for radon when they do their projects. I don't have much about the specifics of the bill, but can speak in general about the notion of certifying contractors to do work. So quickly, what's Clean Energy Works? We're the largest home performance nonprofit in Oregon. We transform homes, make them safer, healthier, more efficient, and more valuable. What do? We connect homeowners with a network of 37 qualified contractors throughout the state. provide financing if homeowners need it through a network of 7 lenders. We do 100% quality control inspection on all work that's performed, and we've generated $60 million of revenue for our local contractors throughout the state. We've done over 3,300 projects. Families are saving 15% to 30% on their utility bills from doing projects. Created over 400 new family wage jobs, and that's 1,300 people received paychecks. And these are plumbers, electricians, HVAC workers, insulators. These are the really companies that are part of the fabric of local communities. For every 100 foams, we get 260 tons of CO2 saved, 10 new jobs, and improved comfort and safety for homeowners in Oregon. Radon and energy efficiency are related. Houses act as systems. The home performance approach is based on building science. It's about measuring different characteristics of houses. We require certification of our contractors, and I'll talk a little bit about training. So I did the PowerPoint mainly for this image. Radon escapes from houses in the same pathways that energy does. So sometimes when we seal houses, we actually increase the radon level. What the motto of the home performance contractors is that we make it tight to save the energy, but we install ventilation systems, which in some cases can include radon bans. To prevent, you know, solving one problem and creating another. Building science is it's an approach to working on houses that's based on measurements, not, as my farmer friends say, poking and hoping. We really understand how systems in the houses interact, and in understanding the characteristics of individual houses and buildings is really important to understanding how radon works. As you know, a house with the basement versus a house with the crawl space under it has a completely different chance of radon occurring and different diagnosis if radon is there. And one of the prime directives of building science is it's that we protect families above everything else. So the contractors that work with Clean Energy Works are certified by the Building Performance Institute, the Construction Contractors Board. They get lead-based paint renovation certification. They're certified by the Energy Trust of Oregon, performance-tested comfort systems, HVAC, plumbers, electricians. There's just a whole laundry list of certifications. It's a part of being a member of building trades that certifications are included. Right now, as far as I know, there's not radon training resources for contractors in Oregon. And Clean Energy Works, one of the things that we've done is we've aggregated the demand and helped contractors get the necessary training to do work. So that's something that we would definitely be willing and able to collaborate with the state to make that available to contractors throughout the state. And that's it. Thank you very much for the time.
Okay, thank you.
I have a whole series of questions.
Okay.
And the reason I have a whole series, you just happen to be in my bailiwick. You've entered my house. Thank you. Sir, you said that 21,000 radon is a deaths per year?
Correct.
By EPA. How many in Oregon?
So right at this point, you can't actually open up a tumor and say one was definitively caused by smoking or radon or, you know, what other causes are out there. These are actually pulled from different studies that have been done by the Environmental Protection Agency. And the number itself is actually from a report. It's the biological effects of ionizing radiation. They're
6 report. If you break this down into Oregon percentages, though, so it's estimated that about 10% of all lung cancer incidents are actually caused by radon. That includes both smokers and non-smokers. So if you break it down, there's an average of 2,655 lung cancer incidents per year in Oregon over the past, that was actually from 2004 to 2008, according to the Oregon State Cancer Registry. So 10% of that would be 265 Oregonians per year would develop lung cancer due to radon exposure.
That's a speculation, though. It's not an accuracy. It's an extrapolation of a broad formula.
Correct.
So we don't know exactly in Oregon. The reason I ask that is, as I am looking at a map here of radon in the state of Oregon, and probably a little less than half the counties have less than 2 picocuries per liter of radon, and Clackamas County is one of them. And the rest of the state are 2 to 4. So there is a possibility that in the rest of the counties they might be broaching 4, which is environmentally safe, correct?
Chair Dembrow and members of the committee, this gets a little complicated. There is no safe exposure to radon. So the number 4 was developed by the EPA. Really what that came down to, a big chunk of what that number was based on, were cost benefits. Any exposure to radon carries some hazard. The maps that have been produced and the zip code data that you can find on our website give averages. These are basically averages that we get test results from test kit manufacturers, and we kind of average these together and come up with maps to kind of give an idea. The big caveat with these maps is that the levels can vary significantly from house to house. So you may test your house and find very low levels, but your neighbor may have something like 10 picocuries per liter. That's not uncommon at all. So the drive home point that we have for the public is that every house should be tested, because you might be that one house on the block that has high levels compared to everybody else.
Well, then let me ask you a question. The drive home point then would be, this building is unsafe. We shouldn't be here. We shouldn't be in this building because this is a thermal funnel of radon, and we're all sitting here.
Are you talking about the Capitol building?
The Capitol, the building we're in right now.
I'm not sure if this building's actually been tested, but in larger structures, the dynamics are a little bit different than a home. There's air handling systems, and that typically has a different effect on radon concentrations. That includes schools as well. And the testing is different in a building like this than it would be in a school as it would be in a home.
Thank you. Let me go on to Mr. Tucker. Mr. Tucker, you're in the business, and you've been a radon specialist for over 20 years. What do you do to mitigate radon in a home, in a crawl space? I assume you deal in the crawl space.
Yeah, I've dealt with homes and schools and large buildings. Real quickly to your last question, just as a extra point, the World Health Organization's action level has been set at 2.7. And I'm not sure what map you're looking at there, but the EPA map is somewhat antiquated. The more recent research and data published by Brett's office and PSU Geology Department are more the more current data. As far as radon mitigation, basically a building, home or any building, typically acts like a giant chimney. You get what's called stack effect, heat rising.
What do you do to
mitigate it?
Mitigate that.
Well, if you consider, real quickly, if you consider that heat rising as a suction, it's a negative pressure. You typically create a negative pressure in the soil under a building that's greater than the pull of the building. So basically, you're telling the radon, don't listen to the pull of the building, stay down, and give it a path of least resistance out, which is typically mechanized with an exhaust fan.
So what do you do? Do you dig under the building? Do you put pipes under the crawl space and pressurize them?
Give you a very close example, West Salem High School. Thorough testing was done. It turned out there was only a couple of rooms. That's another good point. The school's most of the time, it's not a whole facility thing. It's very pinpoint. As long as you do proper diagnostics up front, one classroom, we put in what's called a sub-slab or subsoil depressurization system. Essentially, we drilled a hole through the foundation to the gravel, the aggregate under the slab and under the vapor barrier that's under there, sealed a vent pipe into it, ran it up the side of the building to above the roof, installed an exhaust fan. The fan runs 150 watts like a large light bulb. Solved the problem. The levels are now below 2 picocuries, which is less than half the EPA action level.
How much did that cost?
That cost about $4,300.
How much?
About $4,300.
$4,300. Mm-hmm. What would it cost to mitigate a 2,000-square-foot house, just off the top of your head? What would you do there? How would you, if you had a home, what would you do?
Well, the system of design for that I described for West Salem High School is pretty simple for a school mitigation, although it's still more involved in a home. A typical home works in a similar way. If you've got a slab-on-grade type floor, whether it's a basement or just a slab-on-grade, you typically will seal a vent pipe in the soil under the slab, run a vent pipe to that sump, if you will, seal the vent pipe into the sump, run it to above the roof line by one way or the other, either internally or on the exterior, and you'll attach a exhaust fan in line with that pipe, that vent pipe, and that fan via the vent pipe sealed to the soil creates a negative pressure that depressurizes the soil, suppresses the radon.
What would that cost?
Residential usually ranges anywhere from about $1,500 to $2,500.
Okay.
A larger house could be up to $5,000. So.
Follow up?
Yeah, just a sec, Senator Olson. Senator Hess, you had a question. Was that related to this?
Thank you. Yes, I was going to ask about costs. I recently went through this with my home, and it was expensive, mm-hmm. and the devices were expensive. And I was just wondering about schools, and there's 198 school districts, and what it would cost to test a school and how expensive it would be.
Typically, we're brought in after school district has done their own testing, which has been the case here in Salem, for instance, Salem-Kaiser School District. Excuse me, I was going to bring up some numbers for you. So typically, it's really unusual for a school mitigation, and we're talking a pretty large facility, to start to nip at $20,000. On average, you're probably talking $5,000 to $6,000. As long as thorough diagnostic testing is done up front, you can save the taxpayer. This is, of course, a public school speaking, quite a bit of money. For instance, at Candelaria, we put together a proposal that was phased. The first phase was diagnostics, following up what the school had already done, just to pinpoint where the source points were. That dialed us into two key areas. We did some trial tests. And basically what that amounted to is that the last phase of our mitigation was over $17,000. That was just one phase. We didn't do that because of the diagnostics and the pinpoint testing that we did. So basically, say the school district, we didn't go into that last phase, though we could have. But I'm a taxpayer, too. I got kids in school. So I feel good about that, personally.
Further questions for Mr. Tucker?
But we are on a timeline. So.
I know. This will be my last one. When you look at building codes and adding these things to building codes, first off, when you put a fan in it, I assume that fan runs 24/7.
It does.
So you've got an electrical consumption that's going to be have to be accounted for. And a 150-watt bulb running 7 days a week, 365 days a year is going to be expensive. But my point is, if you have a house that puts a remodel on there and they don't meet the radon tests, and so the house, you can't occupy the remodel, what do you do with the rest of the house? Do you kick the folks out?
Radon mitigation is typically a whole building solution, whether it's an apartment building, whether it's a home. And so typically radon mitigation in a residence only takes one day.
But the problem is it says a remodel. So if I go to do a remodel on a home,
mm-hmm.
that means they're going to have to put cost into the entire house for a perceived radon problem.
It is recommended that you do a test before you do the remodel to find out if there's an existing problem so that you can be planning ahead. So just a good example, if I may, would be if you find out ahead of time that you've got a soil moisture problem and you're going to have a flooding basement, you plan ahead, you put a French drain system in. I think that's fairly analogous.
Right, but it says here that you're under the construction standards, they may not be approved for occupancy unless the basement addition has been tested to determine radon levels. So if a homeowner goes in and does a remodel and finds out that he has high radon levels, he can't occupy his building. He's kicked out.
I believe that's talking, is that not speaking to brand new construction, standalone construction?
Yeah, you're looking at section 4.
Section 6.
Section 6.
Just, my understanding is the logic there is it just like any other sort of pre-occupancy sign-off, that you've shown that the system that's been put in per code is or isn't working. If it's not working, it's activated with a fan.
I guess the point is that since I'm in the industry, you're adding another $5,000 to $10,000 to the cost of a home, which is going to impact our industry greatly.
The cost I gave you is a retrofit cost.
Okay.
To build in what's minimum code, we're talking 30-40 feet of 3-inch ABS or PVC pipe to a T in the aggregate under the vapor barrier. Since you're a builder, I use some nuts and bolts language. That's taken up to above the roof. And a J-box is put in the attic where a fan can live if it's needed, if the house tests or the building tests high after it's been finished. If it tests high, you add a fan to that. It's wired to the J-box. It's in the attic. That'll cost you a couple $100. And the energy use for a typical fan, which is anywhere from 14 to about 75 watts, since you've got a system built in, you can use a much smaller fan. And at 14 to, say, 25 or 30 watts, you're talking well less than $50 a year in electrical
use. What's your test cost?
The testing cost?
Yeah.
If it's done professionally, it ranges anywhere from $60 to $190, depends on who does the test and what the test involves.
Gentlemen, thank you very much. We're probably going to be calling on you as this thing evolves to get some input on, making some refinements and tweaks. So if you could be available for that, I'd really appreciate it.
I'd be happy to.
Sure.
Great. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's turn to Andrea Simmons from the Building Codes Division. Andrea, thank you for joining us by phone. If you could give us briefly your perspective on this issue.
Yes, Senator. I'm going to keep it at a real high level. Unfortunately, I have a meeting at 4 that I need to go to. Essentially, what I wanted to cover today is the current construction standards for radon mitigation. It's been talked about quite a bit already, but in residential, there are essentially three options. One is a mechanically vented crawl space, and in that area, you would also seal the floors, so that way there would be no penetration of the house structure itself. Typically, what's used and is more common, the mechanically ventilated system is where the gentleman was talking about the fan. What's more common is the use of a passive system, which is typically a layer of Vesqueen, and the radon, if any, the building code actually applies to certain counties, whether or not radon is in existence on that particular site or not. If any radon exists, it then goes through a stack that ventilates through the roof, as was discussed earlier. Third option was created in Oregon that is weird and ties in nicely with the energy code. And in that case, you must have a whole house ventilation system. You have to have openings in the foundation. Again, you seal the floors and the ducts to prevent penetration into the living quarter areas. And the structure must pass a blower-door test. Page 4 of one of the handouts that I hope you received, there should have, committee members, you should have received 3 of them. The one that is labeled Appendix F on page 4 has a diagram in the back that is a typical system. On the commercial side, 2010 legislation, fire covered building mitigation, there was no national standard. Our Oregon State Building Code standards are based at national standards, but there wasn't any for us to rely on. What we ended up doing is we found the state of Florida was in the process of looking at radon standards for commercial buildings, for public buildings. Yeah, we borrowed from Florida. Florida based our requirements on that. But the Florida requirements did not go forward. And we will need to revisit our standards at some point in time. For multifamily housing or other structures where there's several dwelling units in them, the requirements are very similar to the residential requirements, and I just went over at a very high level. However, the third option with the whole house ventilation system and the blower door test is not an option for apartments or dormitories. Public building, where again that the bill required us to do public buildings, and this is typically most public buildings are a concrete floor. It requires a membrane material, again, underneath the slab, and you seal the joints and the concrete itself in that situation. And the ventilation system, in this case, again, we're talking about the piping that was already discussed earlier that goes through the roof, can be active or passive. The commercial setting, they are required for every 2,000 square feet, or if you use a combination of a concrete slab foundation and another type of foundation, you would need to put another ventilation system there at that particular point. The current standards in Oregon, I'd be happy to answer any questions on that if you have any.
I've got a question.
Okay, Senator Hansel.
Andrea, Senator Bill Hansel here. You said that we patterned a lot of this after Florida, and then Florida did not adopt them. Do you know why Florida did not adopt them?
Sir, I am not sure why Florida did not adopt them.
Then why are we adopting them, or proposed to adopt them?
So the statute required us, that was passed in 2010, to adopt standards for public buildings. There were no national standards. We looked at the EPA to see if they had standards. They did not. And so this was a proposal that was already being, you know, discussed that we picked up on. We didn't use Florida's verbatim. It did go through a significant review process with stakeholders. But we had to start somewhere, and so that's where we started.
Thank you.
And Andrea, have there been problems with those standards?
None that I'm aware of, sir.
Okay, thank you very much, Andrea, for that information, and I'm sure we'll be calling on you further.
Okay.
Thank you. John, did you want to make some comments, or are you okay? Okay, I'd like to call up John Chandler. He wants to give a brief perspective.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association. My comments will be very brief, mainly to put a placeholder in. This issue is actually Mr. Scott Berry's. I've worked for the home builders for 25 years, and I've been very diligent about not knowing anything about building codes. So Scott will be with us. If this bill does move forward, Mr. Berry will be handling it for us. I did want to have let the committee know that we have some significant concerns with the LC as it's been presented. The current law, as Andrew and others have already indicated, requires us to do radon mitigation and new construction in those areas where radon is a problem in its background levels. We don't know if there's any problems with that current system. Extending the requirements to remodeling causes a lot of heartburn because that's very difficult to do. It can be very expensive. And as I talked to the chair earlier today, one of our biggest concerns about the bill is the separate licensure of radon inspectors being done by an agency that isn't currently licensing other parts of the building codes division has electricians, and that's about it. Everything else happens at the contractors board. It just creates all sorts of havoc for the industry when we have licensure requirements, assuming this bill were to pass, spread amongst multiple agencies. It's just there's a lot of issues that we've been more than happy to work with you. And when I say we, I mean Mr. Berry, assuming this bill moves forward in February, because we're not opposed to protecting the public through radon mitigation or any other matters that are necessary. We do appreciate it when those are done in a way that we can actually do sensibly and efficiently and without a lot of overlapping and redundancy. So with that, I'd be happy to make up anything about building codes you might want, but I'll conclude my remarks.
Yes.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Chandler? Yeah. Okay, thank you, John.
Thank you.
We'll certainly get in touch with Mr. Berry as we move forward with
this. Please do. Give him my love when you...
and again, you know, I will say that the goal as far as the certification was that we would be using the national industry certification that's out there. It would be processed through, you know, an Oregon state agency because we have to do that. But the legislation, the proposed legislation kind of makes clear that that is the goal, to use the national, not for us to recreate or create our own, but to use that national certification.
I understand. So, well, Mr. Chair, we'll reserve the right to argue with you about whether or not certification is needed, but certainly the logistics of that is something we'd want to weigh in on. Thank you very much.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Regarding national certification, the problem with that is that we don't have local control over it. As they change national certification, we lose any fundamental ability to control our own destiny, and we would be much better with local certification if we were to do anything.
Okay, good point. All right, so I'm going to close this informational hearing on radon mitigation, By the way, Vice Chair Olson, you know, given your expertise in this area, I'm really going to look to you for some help as we're pulling people together to talk about this.
I'm going to be like John Chandler and refer you to Scott Berry.
Okay. That's great. Okay. So, colleagues, we're moving into the last hour of the hearing, and I think what I'd like to do now, if you don't mind, is actually jump ahead and open the work session for the purpose of getting these LCs into the queue so that if anybody has to drift off, you've had a chance to vote on this. So, Vice Chair Olson.
I'm going to pass.
Mr. Chair, I move that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills, LC 149, dated 1-10-2014, LC 157, dated 1-14-2014, LC 243, dated 1-10-2014.
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead. Senator Bates moves that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills, LC 149, dated January 10, 2014, LC 157, dated January 14, 2014, and LC 243, dated January 10, 2014. LC 157 was dated January 14, right, 2014. And colleagues, just to kind of remind you that what you're being asked to do is just simply get these bills into the queue. Your vote on that does not indicate support of the bill, certainly not at this point. There will be informational sessions and public hearings, there may or may not be work sessions on these.
Mr. Chair,
yes,
I make a motion, since I will not be supporting LC 243 and I don't want to delay the implementation of the other two, I make a motion that LC 243 be separated from your motion and made a separate motion for approval by the committee.
Okay. Senator Olson would like to exclude, separate the votes, as it were, on these measures. Again, I just want to remind you that we're not dealing here with support or lack of support for the measure. It's just to get these into the queue. But is there support for that separation? I would prefer keeping them together.
I would support it.
Mr. Chair, I'm not going to support it, but I'll say I also have reservations about 243, but I want to continue the discussion.
Yes.
And hear more about it in February. Knowing we have a very short cycle in February, the point has to be made about this being the right way to deal with radon very quickly in February. Otherwise, we're going to put it off until 15. I'll support all three the way they are, but I have reservations about 243.
Okay.
Maybe I'll reassure other members of the committee.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, if I may. The reason I made the motion is I do want to support the other two, but I do not support this as it's written. And so I would not feel compelled to vote yes on all when I would want to vote. I would end up voting no on all of them.
Okay, I appreciate
that. That's why I wanted to make that motion.
That's a fair point. We'll separate them out.
Mr. Chair, I would move that we have got a motion on the floor, I guess. How do we do this parliamentarily?
I think you just withdraw.
I'll withdraw my motion.
And then make a motion.
No, so can I make a new motion?
Okay, that motion is withdrawn. And Senator Bates?
Mr. Chair, I would move that LC 149 dated 1/10/2014, LC 157 dated 1/14/2014, may introduced as a committee bill.
Okay. Senator Bates moves that LC 149 dated January 10, 2014, and LC 157 dated January 14, 2014 be introduced as committee bills. Any discussion? Any objection? Okay, seeing none, those bills are introduced as committee bills. Senator Bates?
Chair Dembro, I move that LC 243 dated 1/10/2014 be introduced as a committee bill.
Okay, Senator Bates moved that LC 243 dated January 10th, 2014 be introduced as a committee bill.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Can we do a roll call?
Oh, of course.
Okay.
Yeah. If there are any further discussion? Okay.
I just want to make it clear that this is a courtesy vote for me, at least for this time. I have concerns about the bill, but I want to continue the discussion.
Great. Shelley, would you call the roll, please?
Senator Bates?
Aye.
Senator Hansel?
No.
Senator House?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
No.
Chair Dembro?
Aye. Okay, the motion passes. LC 243 is introduced as a committee bill. Okay, I'm going to close the work session on introduction of committee measures, and we're going now to move to what I think will be a very interesting presentation on the effects and dealing with the effects of climate change in Oregon as it affects particular industries. And for that, I'd like to call up Jeff Stone, Sam Tannehill, and Alan Barton, please. I heard a version of this in my previous life as a House member back in September, and got to hear Jeff give testimony on this, which I found so compelling that we brought him back.
No pressure.
Lucky you.
Are you saying this is
doesn't
a rerun?
Sure.
So we now have people speaking about three of the things that we feel most proud of in Oregon, right? Our foliage, our nursery goods, our vineyards, and our shellfish.
Well, it's good to hear that about the wineries. I've prepared a little bit of a statement and one of those PowerPoint presentations. Thank you, Beth, very much. If there's any questions, I guess we'll take them after. Chair Dembro and members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to appear before you and give my views on how climate change has affected and will affect the Oregon wine industry. Obviously, not only is it an important topic for my industry, but for the entire Oregon agriculture industry, the state, and everybody that lives here. I've attached a bio, so you all have a little bit of background information on me as well. Today I'm here not as representative of any official organization, just as a business owner and concerned citizen here in Oregon.
Sam, Sam, can I just jump in? I'm sorry.
Yeah.
For the record, you have to give us your name.
That's right. It's been a while. Sam Tannehill, A to Z Wineworks, founder, director of viticulture and winemaking.
And you also need to bring us samples?
I know. Well, I know that the OWA is having a legislative meeting reception after this, so hopefully everybody can get over there and taste some of those samples.
Depends how fast you are. We have caucus of five.
I'm going to be fast. So why is climate change important to the Oregon wine industry? It's the geology and, more important, the climate in Oregon that gives us the ability to craft world-class wines. In the wine world, it is not necessarily the who and the how, but the where that is of utmost importance to the quality of the wine. Around the world, regardless of geology, however, the best grape-growing regions that produce the most complex wines are in certain areas where the vines are just barely able to ripen grapes. When we discuss ideal ripeness in the wine world, we're referring to an elusive balance of color and flavor components, acid and sugar. This balance is achieved only in very specific climates, just a bit too warm or a bit too cold, and the balance and complexity that defines world-class wines is lost. With cool nights and warm, long days during the growing season, and mostly dry, cool weather during harvest, Oregon has traditionally had a temperate climate that is ideally suited to producing world-class wines. However, this perfect climate is extremely fragile and is being threatened. Oregon is lucky to have one of the wine industry's foremost climate researchers and analyst, Dr. Greg Jones, teaching at Southern Oregon University. He wasn't able to come today, but did prepare a presentation on how climate change has been changing and the potential effects on the global wine industry. The facts and conclusions of the presentation should come as no surprise. The climate's getting warmer, weather is getting more extreme, and these changes affect us and what we do. What may come as a surprise is that in between 50 to 80% of prime vineyard acreage worldwide today could potentially be not suitable for growing premium wine grapes by 2040. So I've got the PowerPoint presentation. We can run through that really quickly. So how do I move this here? I'm not a PowerPoint guy. There we go. We've got the global temperature departures from 2012 real quickly here. Once again, these shouldn't really come as a surprise. They've been all over the news. We've got 2012 was the 10th warmest year on record. All 12 years to date are in the 21st century, rank among the 14 warmest. Only 1 year during the 20th century is warmer than 2012. 2012 was the 36th year in a row above the 20th century mean. If you were born after April 1985, you're not drinking wine. I guess you are 27. You have never lived through a month that was on the earth that was colder than average. So preliminary 2013, average global temperature in January, November temperature is 1.1 degrees Fahrenheit above the 20th century average. Record wetness was observed over parts of northern and central eastern United States, parts of Europe, across areas of Russia, and much of India. Record dryness was scattered across different parts of the globe in the different countries that are mentioned. Global temperature departures from 1880 through 2012. Slowing down of warming, a lot have been said, but observations and modeling have shown that cooler than normal Pacific SST have been absorbing much of the heat at a great depth. There's also been a little cold. There's been a little cold season warming, but the warm season has been significantly warmer, greater ice loss, extremes, etc. Combined, the warming has slowed, but it's still much warmer in the past. These are just some facts that I put in here, something that are interesting to put out to think about that we're living through. And one of the reasons why we're seeing these dramatic events is a slowing of the jet stream, which is making greater transitions from north to south, and we'll talk about that in a minute. The other thing that I thought was an interesting comment here is that in Russia, snow is being transported and stockpiled for the Winter Olympics because there's simply not enough snow there this year. 2013 ended as the driest year ever in California and across many areas of Oregon. Many of these records are not just broken but obliterated by as much as half of what precipitation has received on average in many locations. We'll also talk about that and droughts coming up as being a threat to the wine industry. So climate variability. It's one of the things that we talked about before. We've got increased climate variability due to the slowing of the jet stream and seeing more north-south amplitude, and we're seeing those changes potentially down in the southern hemisphere as well, where there is lots of wine growing to be had. March 2012 was exceptionally warm over most of the United States, while March 2013 was much cooler than average. Over the last 10 years in the U.S., more extreme records in temperature and precipitation have been broken than in the previous 40 years combined. So we've obviously got something going on. Climate change, viticulture, and wine production. We'll go over these some a little bit later in a minute. Climate and average climate structure and variability, warmer and longer growing season, warmer dormant periods, reduced frost damage in some areas, though not in Oregon, altered ripening profiles, wine styles, we discussed that a little bit, earlier phenology, altered new disease, pest timing and severity, changes in soil fertility and erosion, CO2 fertilization, but with what wine effects, water availability and timing of irrigation, some places drier, some places wetter. We talked about the global viticultural zones being in the temperate areas, and there's going to be a shift moving both north and south depending upon what hemisphere you are in, depending upon where you want to plant and what type of vines you want to plant. This is actually a slide that I put in showing the areas that in red that will, in 2040, this is a climate and wine grape study that was just published in the PNAS, and showing in the red areas where where premium wine grapes will no longer be planted, and shifting to the more blue areas, the dark blue being the core of where the new areas are, and the light blue being areas that have opened up that have never been planted to viticulture, or at least in our times that will be potentially possible to plant there because of warming temperatures. This is in the Willamette Valley. It shows different grapes that have been planted and the average growing season temperature needed to ripen those plantings. Today, the climate ranges from 54 to 61 degrees during the growing season. That's the Willamette Valley in 1981 through 2010. You can see Pinot Noir, Riesling, Gewürztraminer, Pinot Gris, Müller-Thurgau ripening fairly well. And then by mid-century, the 2040 that we talked about, the 2070, the range is going to go up, and grapes are sensitive. So that's what the Willamette Valley is going to look like as far as varieties being planted. We're going to see some Sauvignon Blanc, more Chardonnay, Cabernet Franc, Tempranillo, Syrah, which is traditionally a Mediterranean variety, and this is just the Willamette Valley. So that's it right there. That information will be available. So how will these changes impact the Oregon wine industry? Most importantly, I think the increase of extreme weather events that climate change brings will become and has become and will continue to be a grave threat. For example, we all remember Typhoon Pabuk's visit and the resulting wettest September in Oregon's history. It turned one of Oregon's earliest and potentially easiest harvests into a muddy near disaster. We're talking tractors and trucks up to their axles in mud in the middle of vineyards. Frost and freeze damage in both spring and late fall become more commonplace, especially in southern Oregon. Insects that thrive in warmer weather and are vectors for diseases common in California will migrate to Oregon. Increased disease pressure due to wetter weather in the spring and fall and hail in the summer will result in loss of crop. Competition for natural resources, most importantly water, will accelerate due to human migration to Oregon, drought conditions in areas of the state, and drier summers. So what can we do as an industry and as a state to overcome these challenges that climate change will bring? We must first start with the assumption that the Oregon wine industry is now an integral part of the landscape and not going anywhere soon. There is simply too much money invested in land, vineyards, equipment, buildings, people, and brands. Second, we need to accept that some of the changes brought by the change in climate are irreversible or impossible for our industry alone to stop or reverse. Third, we need to make sure that in spite of this, the Oregon wine industry is doing all it can to mitigate climate change. Although we tend to crow about our sustainable accomplishments, we want to acknowledge that we have a lot more work to do. Lastly, we need to work with other industries, groups, and the state to find ways to mitigate the changes and adapt to the challenge facing us. Some of these examples of adaptations we have already made include planting in cooler areas of the state, looking at different varieties for more suitable to warm climates and extreme weather, installing state-of-the-art spraying and irrigation systems that conserve water, looking at technologies such as reverse osmosis in the winery to remove water from grape must or alcohol from finished wine. The list goes on. However, what all of these examples boil down to is investment. What do I mean by investment? I mean investment into wine and grape research on understanding variety, suitability, and adaptability, research into vine and grape genomics, research into vineyard management, and research into new technologies in the cellar. We need investment into rural communities and schools where climate change will have the largest impact and where the majority of our vineyards are and will be located. If we as an industry and a state increase investment in research and education, we will not only support our industry, but also support a skilled labor pool that will ensure a vibrant wine industry and rural communities long into the future. We have an opportunity, for instance, at Oregon State University to create the best fermentation sciences program in the United States. Let's seize that opportunity and attract world-class scientists that will work hand-in-hand with industry and try to find solutions to climate change that are unique to Oregon. Oregon has a reputation of crafting higher quality, value-added agricultural products. Let's invest in Brand Oregon and solidify that reputation nationally and internationally. If our agricultural products can achieve a 20% premium over other wines or agricultural products from different areas, we can reinvest that difference into finding ways to adapt and keep our quality high. Let's invest on studies how we can best move forward with clean fuels in the road and the vineyards and studies to show how we can efficiently and affordably contribute to reducing emissions and offset the true cost of production through a carbon tax. Let's continue to invest in sustainability and find ways to cut back on our electrical, chemical, and water footprints. Let's reinvest in the land use system and find ways that vineyard and increased population and development can coexist and share natural resources amicably as these resources become stressed. These investments will not only help the Oregon wine industry, but the entire state economy and those that live here. In summary, Oregon's climate is the most important reason we are able to craft world-class wines. As this climate changes, we have and will need to find better ways to adapt to these changes in order for our industry to continue to thrive. We realize that we cannot do this alone. The wine industry in Oregon is but part of an interconnected tapestry of businesses, individuals, and livelihoods that are being threatened by climate change. We need to collaborate and work together with the state to make investments in the future through marketing support, education, and research. We need to work together to help find unique solutions to the challenges that lie ahead. I think lastly, it's important to remember that while we can make wine anywhere in the world, it's only possible to make Oregon wines in Oregon. We're making world-class wines in Oregon today. Let's make sure that in 100 years that is still the case. Thank you for your time.
Tim, thank you very much for that overview. And we'll probably come back.
Happy to take questions.
Yes. Alan, do you want to talk
sure,
to us
I guess,
about the coast?
Sure. I guess oysters and wine go pretty well together.
They do indeed.
And I don't have any samples, but hopefully you guys did attend the reception we had last night where there were quite a few samples served. So I'm actually going to do a PowerPoint, so if I can maybe swap seats with you.
No worries.
Senator Dimbro, members of the committee, my name is Alan Barton. I work at Whiskey Creek Shellfish Hatchery over in Neatart, and today I'm going to talk about some of the problems we've been experiencing over the past 7 to 8 years and how we now understand that those problems are directly linked to ocean acidification in Pacific Northwest waters. Just to introduce our industry, we've been around for a while. We've been farming oysters commercially for about 150 years, and we currently support about 3,000 family wage jobs. These are jobs in rural areas along the coastline, and that activity contributes about $300 million a year to economic activity in the region. Although we're spread throughout the region, much of our harvested product comes from Washington State, while a lot of our seed product comes from Oregon. Our job truly is a way of life. Having been in the industry now for 10 years, I finally figured out what that means. When a guy tells you your job is a way of life, it means you need to work on the weekend, which I do and probably always will. But it really is a way of life. It's something I'm proud to be a part of. There are a lot of fourth and fifth generation farmers in our industry. It's something I want to continue to be a part of, but we have some very significant challenges facing us today that we need to address. Just for informational purposes, oysters have a larval period at the beginning of their life, so they swim around for the water column for 2 to 3 weeks. That's what we do at Whiskey Creek. We grow oyster larvae and sell those to growers throughout the region. So we grow them right up until they're just about ready to attach to a hard surface. Then we wrap them up in a damp towel, ship them out in FedEx boxes to growers all over the Northwest. When they arrive at his farm, he loads a tank full of bags of clean oyster shell, fills the tank with seawater, and throws in the larvae. Within 24 hours, he's got oyster seed attached to his bags. Those bags are then planted in the bay, and then hopefully 2 or 3 years later, he gets rich farming oysters. So that's the general concept of our industry. The bottleneck for us always has been, always will be, producing enough larvae to supply the needs of our growers. But now that we're having problems producing larvae in our hatcheries, it's already had a pretty big economic impact on our industry, to the tune of tens of millions of dollars a year in lost harvested product. These are some photos of our facility, basically a lot of big tanks. We pump water straight out of the bay and try to grow larvae. We've been very successful at it. We started in 1978 and are one of three major hatcheries that supply our industry. The other two hatcheries, however, are part of really big farms. You may have heard of Taylor Shellfish or Pacific Seafood. So their first priority in a hatchery is to supply larvae to themselves. If they have additional larvae, that's sold to the dozens of other growers throughout the region. What that means is if you're not one of these two farms, you probably depend on Whiskey Creek for larvae for at least some part of the growing season. So when we started having trouble back in end of 2007, and frankly, ever since then we've been having trouble, it's not just a problem for the five or six guys working in our hatchery. It's a problem for thousands of jobs throughout the region, and a lot of angry phone calls as well. We now understand that these problems are most severe during the summertime upwelling season. Upwelling is a normal process along the Oregon coast. It's a good thing. Nutrients come up from the deep ocean, and that's why our fisheries are some of the most productive in the world. But unfortunately for us, the water that's upwelling now is a little bit more acidic than it used to be, at least in human terms. If you're an oyster larvae, it's a lot more acidic than it used to be, and we routinely see water every summer at our hatchery that can dissolve the shells of sensitive marine animals like the larvae that we try to grow for a living in our hatchery. The reason it's a little bit more acidic than it used to be is because of ocean acidification. You know, climate change is pretty difficult, involves a lot of complicated models that I don't understand. Ocean acidification is extremely complicated, but it's a little bit easier to understand in that if there's more CO2 in the air above the water, it will dissolve into the ocean, and that will decrease the pH of the ocean. The reason we care about that is because when the pH of the ocean drops, there's less carbonate available in the ocean, and carbonate is one of the main building blocks of shell, right? So it's harder for them to grow their shell. Just like any other animal, the babies of oysters are the most sensitive. The babies, the larvae that we grow in our hatchery are very sensitive to these effects. And what we have already seen along the Oregon coast has produced some devastating consequences for our production at Whiskey Creek. If you've heard about ocean acidification, what you probably heard is it mentioned as a global problem. It is, of course, a global problem, and there are pretty dire projections for what our ocean's going to look like by the turn of the century. But it turns out that oysters and oyster larvae really don't care about the global annual average pH of the world's ocean. They don't live in the global ocean. They live in very narrow regions of the coastline, and they spawn and reproduce typically only in the summer months. So if we narrow our focus to coastal environments, we can tell a much more scary story than the already scary story of OA, which is that we don't need to wait till the year 2050 for it to affect us. It's already affected us. It's already almost run out of business back in 2009 and had a big economic impact on our industry. To look at these coastal regions in more detail, thanks to the Oregon and Washington legislatures, we were able to build a monitoring program in the areas that we care about, bays that are important to our industry, and we've learned a lot. Essentially, what we've learned is that this is real, and ocean acidification is having a direct impact on our industry, and in particular on our production at Whiskey Creek and other hatcheries throughout the Northwest. We also learned some good things. We learned that there are still some windows of opportunity we can take advantage of and keep our business afloat. And once we understood what the problem was, we've now been able to develop some sophisticated water treatment systems to deal with this bad water and fix it. But this is a short-term approach, right? Every year, we can see it getting harder to fix the water. And every year, our production changes as a result of that. So we have to step back and do some of the hard work, right? That we don't really want to do. We want to work in the hatchery and produce larvae, but we're forced to start thinking about the global problem of CO2 emissions because we have no other option. Some of you guys might not like oysters. You might think they're slimy and not like to eat them, but I'm sure we all care about salmon in the Northwest. We work very closely with guys in a group called the Sustainable Fisheries Partnership. They're very concerned about ocean acidification, and they're not concerned about it in the year 2050. They're concerned about it now. because of food sources for juvenile salmon or shell-forming organisms that are a heck of a lot like the larvae we produce in our hatchery. So you can be sure that if we're seeing effects, these organisms are being infected in the natural environment as well. So as I said, I'm not an environmentalist. I don't want to be here talking about this problem. I want to go back to work and produce larvae and make money. I'm a businessman. My business depends on fossil fuels. We use quite a bit of fossil fuels in our business, but I'm forced to be an environmentalist now because I have no other option. If we continue down the road that we're on with fossil fuel emissions, there won't be oyster farmers by the turn of the century. We might be the Jellyfish Growers Association. You may have seen us in the media referred to as the canary in the coal mine for what's happening to our coastal oceans. I come here and try to raise awareness about what we're seeing because I don't want to be a canary in a coal mine. If you're familiar with the historical use of a canary in a coal mine, the canary is supposed to die so that everybody else can make it out. So I don't want to be a canary. The guys in my industry don't want to be canaries. So hopefully by talking to you guys about this, we can make some hard decisions that can keep us around for a little while longer. So that's it. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chair Denbrough, I do not have a PowerPoint presentation. I feel inadequate. I'm Jeff Stone. I'm the executive director for the Oregon Association of Nurseries. To remind you, we are a traded sector. We ship 75% of our plant material throughout the United States, half of it east of the Mississippi, and we're your largest sector of ag, and we're the second largest nursery state in the country. People don't think of Oregon being that big, but we are. I'm here to talk. I have my testimony that you can read, but I'm just going to touch upon a couple high points. Warmer temperatures, we've heard both of these gentlemen talk. Warmer temperatures to us mean that different plants will grow in this temperate zone. So that changes. It's not a jet boat that we race around. It's a super tanker that we turn the wheel, and you have to grow plants for between 3 and 15 years before it gets to market. So it changes the very nature. I don't mean that in a pun-wise, but it changes the very plants that we grow. Secondarily, and more horrifying to us, is the change in pest and disease exposure. We right now have a very good handle in making sure that we ship clean plant material. But if the temperature's warm, we will face the type of pests and diseases that the state of California has, which is completely different from what we're prepared and to mitigate. The last part is the snowpack. If we believe that the temperature is getting warmer, the reservoir that the snowpack represents and is released during time into our streams will be reduced. And that means it will fall as precipitation. So how we deal with water supply is very critical. I want to give you all credit since you all voted for Senate Bill 839, which was the first water supply bill that this state has undergone. I give you a lot of credit for it, but it is the start, not the end, of that whole discussion because municipalities, environmentalists, and ag all have shared outcomes of what we do with water supply and water availability. So what have we done as an industry? 5 years ago, I became the exec of this association, and they passed in my first month that we were going to reduce energy use by 25% in 10 years. So I have 5 years left. And I love the fact that our board wanted to do it, but they just weren't going to greenwash it. They said we need to find tangible ways that we become more energy efficient. So we have done that. We've done pilots through the Northwest Energy Efficiency Alliance, through Energy Trust and others to try to do energy audits to try to find ways that we become more energy efficient. The second is that we know we have a carbon footprint. We ship, as I said, most of our material east of the Mississippi. We know that there's intrinsic value of planting trees and shrubs and helping the environment, but we didn't have a way to quantify that. So we got in a partnership with the Oregon Environmental Council to measure it. And the good news here is that those participating nurseries, and they were very small to the very large, had an average of 20% reduction in their greenhouse gas emissions just by making some best management practices changes and capturing the things that we already do naturally. And there are ways through heat island effect that you hear about how cities are more warm. You can plant trees and shrubs. That helps. Transportation investment, having trees along highways as an investment strategy will help all mitigate the effects of carbon. So what does that mean for an individual nursery. We have one example. Woodburn Nursery and Azalea, just up the road here, changed how they did irrigation. They went from the normal sprinkler head to drip irrigation. So that means they put water directly on the plant. Sorry. He was able to save 60% on his water use. So during a farm bill hearing not too long ago, that same nursery talked about changes he had because he had a $100,000 natural gas bill. And at that time, the congressman asked, $100,000 a year? And he goes, no, a month. $100,000 natural gas bill a month. So he went and did temperature changes. So he increased his efficiency by 70%. To give you scale, it would his savings on the grid would power the town of Independence for a year. So that tells you the type of – and that's someone who didn't have any subsidies. He just did it because he wanted to save money. He wanted to do the right thing. So as an industry, we want to work with our shellfish and winery partners. We want to work with the municipalities. We want to work with the environmental community about coming up with solutions because we all have a shared interest in its outcome. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much.
Did I live up to the expectation? That's a no.
Questions of these gentlemen? Okay. Well, thank you very much for coming. You obviously, your presentations reinforce each other because the problem is a common problem that we're all facing, and I think many of the solutions are as well. So thank you for giving us some concrete examples of why we really need to pay attention to this problem.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for the time.
Yeah. So with that, I'll close the hearing on the effect of climate change in Oregon and open our last informational hearing. And this has to do with the Betsy sunset. So I'm calling up Mike Kaplan to tell us what is going on as we are entering the final stages of the Betsy. The Betsy is due to sunset soon, and what is the department doing to prepare for that? What can we envision? What lessons will there be to be learned from this, or what? How will we do that analysis? And colleagues, let me just back up and say that I guess it was 2 weeks ago, Vice Chair Olson and I met with Mike to talk about issues that had come up around the Stonehouse LLC, which was reported on in the Oregonian, which was a Betsy project that's still potentially out there, the article raised some issues that Mike helped us to understand.
Chair Denbrough, members of the committee, thank you very much for the invitation to testify today. For the record, Michael Kaplan, Deputy Director, Oregon Department of Energy. I'm joined by Maureen Bach, our Energy Incentives Program Manager. I just want to provide some brief history and background for the Betsy program, talk about how the Betsy process works from the applicant and agency perspective, walk through the timeline essentially from now until the sunset of Betsy, which is July 1st, 2014, and we will speak specifically to the Stonehouse Solar Project, which has garnered some attention recently. When the legislature created the Oregon Department of Energy, it noted that continued growth and demand for non-renewable energy poses a serious and immediate as well as future problem. It is essential that future generations not be left a legacy of vanished or depleted resources, resulting in massive environmental, social, and financial impact. Oregonians spend nearly $13 billion a year in Oregon on energy alone. Oregonians' energy costs would be nearly $15 billion a year if not for the state's efforts to save energy. In the last 35 years, more than 24,000 business energy tax credits have been issued to Oregon businesses. Those credits have leveraged more than $3 billion in renewable energy and energy efficiency investments in the state, including lighting, heating, and industrial processes. The Betsy program was created through legislation enacted in 1979, and the last Betsy project will receive its final certification by July 1st, 2014, which I mentioned is the program sunset. The Betsy helped businesses achieve cumulative savings in generation equal to the energy use or the annual energy use of approximately 1 million households. The program helped schools, tribes, businesses, industries, farms, and ranches save energy and invest in renewables. Since 1979, we've received more than 34,000 Betsy applications. We've processed more than 31,000 preliminary certificates, and we've awarded 24,635 final certificates. Through the years, Betsy was amended several times, as shown in the chronology I think you just received. Between 2007 and 2012, the legislature has passed six Betsy bills. The first bill, House Bill 3201 in 2007, increased the Betsy for renewable energy projects from 35% to 50% of eligible project costs and increased the eligible project cost limit for each project from $10 million to $20 million. 3 years later, the 2010 legislature passed a Betsy, or the first Betsy sunset bill, House Bill 3680. Then in 2012, House Bill 4079 was passed to provide a second sunset, a final sunset for Betsy projects that had been demonstrated to the department that they had begun construction by April 15, 2011. The process for an individual Betsy application begins with project owners filing an application for a preliminary certification with our department. If staff determines that the project is technically feasible, likely to perform as represented, and meets other requested criteria, the project owner receives a preliminary certification. The type of documentation required and the level of review performed by the department depended on the type, the cost, and the complexity of the project. After receiving preliminary certification, the project owner could proceed with the project. Upon completion, which includes building and paying for the project, the owner could apply for a final certification. All projects with Betsy preliminary certifications are permitted to submit amendments. The Betsy program provides the ability to make amendments over time to accommodate advances in technology or system improvements or to reflect changes in project ownership. If an amendment results in a reduction of eligible project costs or reduced generation output of savings, this would potentially result in a reduced tax credit amount. To draw a little bit finer line on that, the department inspects all projects with certified projects project costs over $100,000, as well as sampling of lower cost projects. The inspection's purpose is to determine that the project was built as described in the preliminary certification and any subsequent approved amendments. In some cases, a project may be completed as described in the preliminary certification, but may have lower project costs. Because the credit is based on eligible project costs, the tax credit is reduced to reflect the project's costs if lower than approved. In other cases, the amended project may be generating or saving less energy. In that case, the ratio of actual production to the estimated production stated on the preliminary certification is the basis for an adjustment of the final certified amount of the tax credit. Projects do not receive or cannot receive an amount that's greater than authorized. In other words, credit may be less, but it will never be more than what's on the preliminary certification. At this point in time, we have roughly 122 preliminary certifications that must receive their final certification by the sunset of essentially June 30th, 2014, in order to receive their tax credit. The cumulative potential tax credit amount is $86,004,804. The department plans to reach out to all of the owners of those 122 projects to remind them of the sunset, of the approaching sunset, and for the larger projects to start to get an idea of where they are in their process and what we can anticipate from them over the next 6 months. To be eligible for the statutorily extended sunset date of July 1st, 2014, project owners had to provide the department with evidence of construction prior to April 15th of 2011. Under department rules, the evidence included but was not limited to copies of approved building, grading, or other permits issued for the facility dated prior to April 15th. We looked for receipts of road grading to access the site, receipts of construction, delivery of equipment that was listed as part of their preliminary certification, or other similar documents. Just as the department did with project owners subject to the first sunset date for Betsy, the department will be communicating with project owners about the second one. You know, the timeline for us moving forward is starting this month. We'll be notifying project owners of the impending sunset so that they're sure to know that they have roughly 6 months moving forward. Between January and May, we'll be processing final applications. We're going to start to receive them. In fact, we've been receiving them over the last few weeks, and we'll be scheduling inspections for the larger projects. In March, we'll send out another notification letting project owners know that their sunset is approaching, that the program will be closing. And then in June, we'll take an inventory of all of those preliminary certifications that exist that we did not receive final applications for and send letters, again, notifying project owners that their preliminary certification will expire as of July 1st. On July 1st, we'll send a final letter to those project owners letting them know that the tax credit and the program has, or the tax credit preliminary certification and the program has sunset. One specific project that we've, among that universe of 122 that's remaining that we've been asked to address directly today is Stonehouse Solar. Stonehouse Solar is a utility scale, and I'm only going to say this once because it's such a tongue twister, photovoltaic project. The applicant describes the project as a 6.65 megawatt ground-mounted solar PV system located in Christmas Valley, Lake County. The preliminary certified cost is $20 million. The project received its preliminary certification under the name of Alfred Fairbanks, who then incorporated the project as Energetics LLC. The project was subsequently sold to Element Power, which incorporated it as Stonehouse Solar. The project has received and been scrutinized by the Bonneville Power Administration, the Public Utility Commission, the Energy Trust of Oregon. Element is actively developing the project. It will sell power to Pacific Power under a 25-year contract with a negotiated power purchase agreement. ETO staff has reviewed the project and found it to be a reasonable for a project of this size, type, and design. At this time, we're waiting for their final certification. If and when we receive the application, our department will review it, schedule an inspection. If the project is built as described, passes our inspection, it will receive a tax credit, or will receive final certification, which will then lead to a tax credit. The department, just to run very quickly through the timeline, the department received the initial application on June 23rd, 2009 from Alfred Fairbanks. We issued the preliminary certificate on August 21st, 2009. The department issued a revised preliminary certificate to Energetics on July 13th, 2010 to reflect a change in project ownership. The department extended the preliminary certificate to Energetics on February 15th, 2012. This extended the preliminary certification expiration date to January 1st, 2013. The original pre-certification would have expired in June 2012. The extension of that initial pre-certification coincided with the sunset that was placed by the earlier House bill, which I referenced. The department then issued a revised preliminary certificate on May 22nd, 2012 to extend the expiration date to July 1st, 2014. Again, this is a circumstance in which extending the expiration date was a result of House Bill 4079, which allowed the project owners to qualify for the new Betsy sunset of July 1st, 2014, as I previously mentioned, if the project owners could demonstrate that they started construction before April 15th, 2011. The department issued an amended certificate to Stonehouse Solar on November 7th, 2012 to reflect new ownership. And then finally, the department issued an amended certificate to Stonehouse Solar on October 11th, 2013 to reflect a change in address but not location. That's a case where actually the street name changed where they were. That concludes our testimony. I know I ran through that very quickly, but we'd be happy to answer any questions you have, and we appreciate the opportunity to speak today.
Okay. Thank you, Mike. And colleagues, I just want you to know that you know, my intention would be that when the after the program comes to an end, our next interim committee meeting, which would be in September, we're going to want to do a look back on how have these final projects finalized, how many of them actually did go forward, and start moving into some final sort of lessons learned from the whole Betsy experience. As we're looking forward to future tax credit programs. With the Solar House project, I guess one of the questions that was raised by the Oregonian was whether or not the company really met the construction test, prior to the deadline, whether it had really done significant construction towards the project up to that point. What sort of things were done that would have allowed it to meet that requirement?
Chair Dembro, members of the committee, I'm going to pass this question off to our resident expert, Maureen Bach.
Thank you, Maureen.
Chair Dembro, members of the committee, my name is Maureen Bach, and I run the Energy Incentives Program. Excuse me. That project did have significant permitting done at the time that we asked for that information, and they had actually also done an interconnection study had been done by Bonneville Power Commission Administration as well. So there were permits in place. They had also done built some racking to do an R&D kind of project to make sure that they could actually site there. So those were the kinds of things that were demonstrated.
Mm-hmm. So being involved in the permitting process is considered an allowable, you know, meeting of the construction requirement.
Chair Denver, yes, that was one of the things we put in rule.
Chair Denver, members of the committee, just to follow up on that very briefly, one of the feedback that we received when we were developing our rules is, given the length that permitting takes, the amount of time and investment that that takes, that was considered a significant investment of time and resource to allow those projects to qualify for that extended sunset.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Vice Chair Olson.
Thank you very much. As you know, we discussed this issue earlier in this year. Mr. Fairbanks, did he recertify as Energetics LLC, or did he sell that his tax credit outright, or his company outright?
Chair Deborah, members of the committee, Senator Olson, that project was incorporated by Alfred Fairbanks as Energetics.
Okay.
And then we issued a preliminary cert in the name of Energetics.
So he initially made the application as an individual and then incorporated as an LLC, and so you changed it over. Okay, thank you.
That is correct.
Follow up? You know, as we talked about in one of the things in the newspaper article, and you say the preliminary construction that he did out there, I mean, you had mentioned putting in roads, grading, preparing a site for work, applying for a permit. Did he receive those permits?
Chair Denbrough, Senator Olson, members of the committee, yes, he did receive permits.
He received permits, but he didn't receive permits for the 6.6 megawatt, did he? Because when he made his installation, he put in 13 200 amp panels.
I do not recall that from the file.
And that would be the beginning of his construction process that you have allowed to you have considered as a construction process.
Senator Denbrough, members of the committee, Senator Olson, we'd be happy to look into exactly what we don't have the file with us at hand. We can look into exactly what was permitted for,
okay,
and get that information to you.
Well, as Senator Denbrough and I talked about afterwards, you know, had Betsy not been abused throughout its life cycle, perhaps it would have a longer life cycle. But since the abuses are great and egregious, it kind of, you know, this thing came upon us and said, you know, maybe we shouldn't do these anymore. And as I told Senator Denbrough, as we allow these tax credits to go out, which are significant, they broach almost $100 billion, don't they, in tax credits from our state? Isn't it $857 million in tax credits that are available out there that people can use?
Senator Olson, Senator Denbrough, you would have to get the outstanding number from Department of Revenue. We do not administer them after we get them to the project owners.
Fortunately, it was in the newspaper article, so it's about $857 million. As you mentioned, there's a number of outstanding credits that haven't been paid back yet, and Walmart's taken tremendous advantage of that, and that's money that our state loses that we can't use in other areas. That was the importance of you know, some of these things, the trucking company out of Arizona. And this, to me, you know, it's a done deal and it's over with, but it just looked like a scam from any practical viewpoint looking at this. A guy comes out and he's a dentist in Washington and gets $10 million in tax credits from our state.
Well, Chair Denbrough, Senator Olson, we have not issued any tax credits to this project.
Yeah, I understand it, but it's still available.
For the project to receive it, we would still have to see a solar array that generates 6.65 megawatts.
Which leads me to my next question. Does that have to be done by the sunset, or what's the length of time it can go on and to be completed?
Senator Denbrough, Senator Olson, members of the committee, it would have to be completed and have to be paid for by that sunset date in order for us to issue the credits. Mm-hmm.
And I think that is an important point that needs to be recognized.
And a project of that size would require a CPA attestation letter for the project costs.
And Chair Denbrough, Senator Olson, to your earlier point, I think the department is very much looking forward to the invitation that we've already received for, I think, September to come in and talk about lessons learned and to really revisit, because the Betsy does have a really long and influential history, and we'd certainly be open to that conversation about what we have learned from its history.
Yeah. Senator Bates.
And just as a member of Ways and Means, we've talked about this several times, and I've forgotten the numbers now, but if you could bring us in September the remaining liability for the Betsy, and over what period of time that liability exists. I'd like to see what that number is and how many years out it is. We don't have to pay it all the same here, obviously. It's going to be rolling through the tax credits. But I'd like to see what that liability is and how long it extends. You may have to ask revenue for those numbers.
Yeah, we may want to invite revenue to come as well.
Yeah, Chair Dembro, members of the committee, Senator Bates, we can certainly follow up on that, but it may require directly asking Department of Revenue from the legislature as opposed to us. But we'll find out how those mechanics work.
One of the lessons to be learned here is letting an agency sort of run out tax credits with nobody looking at what those tax credits mean and what the long-term effect of them is. We can't even answer now what it is. Frankly, I think they should know that. You should have been asking revenue all along and notifying the legislature or others that, hey, this looks like these projects are getting a lot of hand. Obviously, that wasn't your concern. Your job was to certify and allow, but that's not the way we work in government. So I'm going to ask you some common sense here.
Yeah, it will be really interesting to do the sort of post-program review of this and lessons learned. And I, for one, really look forward to that. I mean, my sense is that the Betsy has spawned a number of very good programs that have had good outcomes, but there have been some abuses or unintended consequences. We need to really learn the lesson. So thank you very much for coming, giving us that update. With that, I'm going to bring this session to an end. And colleagues, any questions or comments for the good of the order?
Didn't it? Okay.
In that case, thank you. We are
the Betsy will be is the